on natural resources and alternative energy together. The reason I'm stumbling over that is because the committee is a compilation of two committees previously. We know that Senator Ringo is out of state. Senator George, his wife had surgery yesterday, and so he is hopefully going to be here, but if he can't get anybody to be with his wife at the hospital, one of the kids or something, he's not going to be here at all. And so that means the only one that's AOL at the moment is Senator Deckard, who said he'd be here. But we do have a quorum, and so I think we ought to get started. First thing is adoption of committee rules for us as a committee. We adopted rules for the Biofuels Committee. Since that committee is part of this committee, that's moot. So these rules are exactly the same, I think, as the Biofuels Committee.
Correct.
And same as every other committee. Is there any question about the rules?
I move that we adopt the rules as proposed.
Is there any discussion of adoption of rules? Is there any objection? Hearing none, they're adopted. Hey, we're right on schedule now.
Mm-hmm.
We have informational meetings. When the committee was originally set up, Senator Courtney said to then-chair Senator Charlie Ringo that it was a natural resources oversight committee, the idea being that we would kind of get some updates on things that are going on. And so we're getting into that. I ought to say just off the top that since this was all put together in the last few weeks, we're going to have a lot of work plan discussion because we haven't had a chance to do this. Everybody, if we'd have done this back in December, it would have happened a lot sooner. But that's why this is happening in front of the committee, because it kind of got kind of smooshed together. So you'll see a lot of other things, but a few things that came to the top early that I felt comfortable in putting on the schedule is the pesticide use reporting update, the forest legacy one, and then something that came up in our last committee that we'll talk about in a little bit. But let's ask Lisa Hansen and her team to come up and just share with us, and I want to invite the committee to ask as many questions as you want. Maybe we'll hold them until you're done, or if you have a burning question, just go ahead and raise that question. Lisa, welcome. Would you introduce your colleagues as well?
Thank you. For the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, the Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And I've brought with me our Assistant Director, Lauren Henderson, who's in charge of our information technology side of this project, and also Chris Kirby, our Administrator of our Pesticides Division, where the pesticide use reporting program will be housed as part of our agency. Thank you so much for the invitation to come and give you an update on our progress implementing the pesticide use reporting system. As just a little bit of background, many of you will remember that the original law was passed in 1999. The early system development was funded by the 2001 legislative session. And during that time, we were advised to develop an electronic-only system. And as we moved through the implementation of this program, there were several issues that were highly controversial. And one of them was how location was to be reported and how confidentiality, maintaining the confidentiality of the data that was collected in the system. As we moved through that initial system development, the budget crisis hit here in Oregon, and basically our project was stopped. The funding for the completion of the project was held. It was put on the shelf and put away. There was no funding provided in 2003, and the 2005 legislative session, thank you, provided full funding for us to complete the system development. So where are we today? We've spent most of the fall doing outreach to our constituency, working with the ag groups, and making presentations and bringing people up to speed. We spent a significant amount of time going back and looking at the work that we had completed and shelved back in 2001 and determined that much of that was reusable. And so we have reinstated contracts with our original developers and move forward with that development. We also have addressed several things that were in administrative rule. Through temporary rule, we reinstated the $40 pesticide registration surcharge to help fund the system. And so that surcharge was collected for the 2006 re-registration timeframe. We do those on an annual basis. And so that funding is in place. We also have proposed in administrative rules to amend several of the issues that the 2005 legislative session addressed, one of which is location, and then some other housekeeping issues along the way. And if you remember, in Senate Bill 290, the agency was directed to implement location in one of two ways. Either third field hydrological unit code for applications that were not urban, and the Department of Agriculture was directed to define urban. When we initially thought about defining urban, we thought about it in terms of city limits, urban growth boundaries, something that was specific and people were accustomed to. However, as we began evaluating the other changes in the law, one of which was the department cannot collect information that would reveal the identity or the location where a pesticide was applied, so cannot collect, we determined that there were likely applications that were made inside an urban growth boundary or inside a city limit that could reveal the location. So we have proposed defining urban by the site type. So if an example of that, an urban application which would be reported by zip code would be a dwelling, an institution, a school, commercial transportation vehicles, ornamental applications for turf and pesticides to parks or golf courses. All other applications, agriculture, forestry, right-of-ways, will be reported by third field hydrological unit. We worked with two groups to help us advise us on these amendments. One were the data.
Yes,
I'm not sure I understood what you said. May I ask a question?
Sure, go.
You're going to report by zip code and by site, type of site.
Okay, let me. I think I probably didn't do a very good job of explaining.
No, I probably didn't listen here, but go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, urban is to be reported by zip code. The agency was to define urban. We are saying an urban application is a type of site.
Okay. And that's by zip code?
Yes.
And outside urban, you can do sites?
There will
be a golf course or something.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, outside of an urban application would be another type of site like an agricultural application or a forestry application. Those would be reported by third field hydrological unit.
Define that.
Third field hydrological unit is a measure of area that's scientifically based, basically, I think, on the watersheds. There are about 15 of them in Oregon, and that was specifically designated in Senate Bill 290 as the other reporting option for location.
Yeah, this was obviously a compromise in the legislative process. So you know where the pesticide is coming from, only in terms of one of those 15 sections of the state.
The 15 hydrological units for agriculture or forestry applications. If it's an urban application, we would know by zip code.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
For clarity, I'll give you an example. Golf course out in the county, not in an urban growth area. What would that fit into?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, if it's a golf course out in the county, not in an urban growth boundary, it would still report by zip code.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, okay. That's helpful to know.
Yeah, I thought I was following right, and I just wanted to make sure it was.
Okay. Any other questions?
It seems like to me.
Any other questions while we're at this juncture?
We don't want to ask too much about golf courses with Senator Deckard present. He might consider that discrimination of some sort.
Dave plays more golf than I do.
Oh, Dave does?
I was just going to let him take the burden.
These are all out in the county. So, you know.
Yeah, yours are the ones that are out in the county.
Yeah, we're out of county. Yeah.
Okay. I think we'll move on now.
To continue on. The agency worked with two advisory groups as we worked through our amendments, data users and data providers. So the research community that likely will be using the data that comes out of the system, as well as people who will be reporting into the system to ground check what we were doing. And we will continue to work with those two groups as we work through the development process and the full implementation. We're in the final stages of completing those rules. In terms of our system development, we have our contractor in place to develop the electronic system. Much of the work that we have been doing has been going back and going through our old documentation and updating that. It's been much about paperwork currently and trying to make sure everything fits together with the new requirements of the law. And we also have our third-party quality assurance in place. They will be providing oversight to the project, and they will do interim reports to the JLCIMT on our progress and any risks that they see as we move forward in this process.
Can you explain third party a little bit, what that means and who that acronym that flew right past me that they're reporting to?
Mr. Chair, third party is somebody outside of the government agency.
I know
it's
that.
A private contractor who will provide quality assurance. He will monitor our process at different points in the project. He will help determine if there's risk. He will make those reports back to the legislature and help point out to us where we might be missing something or have additional risk that we may not have identified.
When you're saying he, are you referring to an individual or a company, a he or a she, or what are you?
He is part of the company, Case and Associates.
Okay.
And Dave Sharon is the individual that will be working with us.
And he will be giving you feedback on... Develop that a little more.
He will be giving us feedback on the development of the project. He will look for high-risk areas, assure that we stay within our budget, assure that we stay within our scope of our project, assure that we hit our milestones in a timely basis.
And if we wanted to, we could see his reports, too, or his recommendations to you.
Absolutely. It's all part of the reports that will go back to JLCIMT.
And that... Again, I hate acronyms.
I'm sorry. It's Joint Interim Legislative Committee on Information Technology.
Okay.
I'll never just okay. Yeah. Well, your technology committee is correct.
Technology committee.
Technology. Questions. Okay. Continue.
As we've moved forward with our implementation, we have had some challenges, and one of them is the result of changes in the law that were implemented in Senate Bill 290. And that being the new or the additional confidentiality that was added, stating that the department may not collect data that would reveal the identity of the owner or lessee of a specific property where a person has applied a pesticide. Two examples of this. One, we don't believe we can have an anonymous system because we need to be able to ground check for compliance and cross check with our base pesticide program. So our solution for working through this is having separate databases for the system. People will come in and register, give us basic information about the pesticide user, name, address, contact information. We are anticipating then that we will develop a mechanism, likely double passwords, to go into the actual reporting system. This may be more cumbersome than what many of the pesticide users would like. In the prior system, it was simpler, but we take our responsibility here very seriously and believe we need to keep the names and addresses of pesticide users separate from the actual pesticide use data, given the changes in the law. The other area that we're evaluating, and this is going to take some more time and some more work that we really didn't foresee at the close of the legislative session, is how useful the data will be on the outside. One of the data points that is required is the type of site. So, for example, for an agricultural application, previously we had anticipated having sites be things like blueberries, cherries, peaches, so that we would drill down agricultural application, a fruit type, and then the type, anticipating that that information could then be used and beneficial to the agricultural industry for FIFRA pesticide re-registration information. Well, we realized that if you're the only peach grower in Harney County, and I use this example because it's very colorful and I don't think it exists, that individual could not report their pesticide use specifically as peaches in whatever third field hydrological unit Harney County is in, because
that immediately identifies them.
Exactly. So the level that this data will be able to be collected at by site is going to be limited, and we're still working through the details of that. I think the same will be true in terms of urban applications. One of the examples would be schools. There's been a lot of interest in understanding what's used in schools, but if it's the only school in a zip code, I don't believe we can have them report as a school. It may just be an urban indoor site. So we're still working through the details of that. But again, we take what was put into law very seriously, and we're trying to find the right blend to get the maximum use of the data, although given the specifics, it may be limited. And finally, our household use survey. We are moving forward with the implementation of our household use survey. We have over 400 households have agreed to participate in the first quarter of 2006. We anticipate about 250 of them will likely finish the diary that they need to keep of their pesticide use. We have a contractor in place that's administering this survey and working with those individuals, making contact with them throughout the quarter to assure that they're filling out their diaries and keeping track of things and doing what we can to help them along the way. So we will have a full year of pesticide use data on the household side for 206. The one thing I think I may have failed to mention, back in the fall when we realized the implementation was going to take longer than we anticipated, we made a decision to put off ultimately mandatory reporting for pesticide users until January 1 of 2007. And the reason for that is we don't anticipate we will have the electronic system complete until late this year, likely October-November timeframe. And we wanted to assure that this time around we have time to have a fully functional, usable system in place so that when pesticide users report, they have a good experience and we don't have a scenario that the system gets overloaded, crashes, and I think ultimately our fear is that causes even more challenges in terms of our implementation than putting off a year of the mandatory reporting data. Okay. So that's a quick summary of what we've been doing, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I'd be glad to take questions too, but I have one first, and that is, given all the parameters, the headaches and so on, and the limitations that you've described, how do you anticipate this being used from your perspective?
I'll give you a quick touch on my perspective, and then I think Chris has some ideas specifically as well. I think ultimately this will give us a picture of the total quantity of pesticides that are used for commercial applications, those that are used in businesses for profit. We're going from the household use survey, I think we're going to have a better sense than what we have today of what households are doing with pesticides and how they're using them and the quantities that are being used. We don't have a mechanism today to even begin to make estimates along those lines. And in terms of the data, there still are some uses potentially that benefit the ag community for FIFRA. but not necessarily in the re-registration process. Chris, would you add anything? Yes.
For the record, my name is Chris Kirby. I'm the administrator of the Pesticides Division. The Regionally Enabling Registration spoke to gathering this information for research purposes, and we all recognize that there are a number of different research purposes. From the standpoint of understanding what quantity of pesticides are used in specific active ingredients, this provides data that Oregon has never had before. So that has a number of uses in and of itself. I think originally focus was on environmental loading, and we still have that kind of data that's coming into us. What we don't have is how the material is being specifically used. So those researchers that are interested in specifically what school children might be exposed to in the school, the way this system is looking right now, they will not be able to get at that kind of data. The best we can do is urban areas. So there's a limitation as to utility of this information for some researchers. But there is still utility for many researchers from the standpoint of environmental loading, from understanding who is using the different active ingredients. Are they being used by agricultural producers? Are they being used in urban areas? Are they being used by households? The system will gather all that sort of information.
Have you given any thought to, or can you give thought to, maximizing utility of the data without infringing on identity issues?
Mr. Chair, clearly we are giving a lot of thought to that, and we're still in the process of evaluating how we do that in the best way possible. But to give you a specific proposal today, we're not that far
mm-hmm.
in our development process, and we'll continue to work through it.
Let us know how that comes out.
We would be happy to do that.
Okay. I did hear somewhere, I think I read an article about a farmer who had somebody come on his property and do an evaluation of his pesticide use, and he found out that he was over-applying a great deal, and that he could cut back on his use significantly, not injure the quality or quantity of what he was growing, and save himself a lot of money. Do you see any relationship between what you're doing and that happening on a bigger basis at all? Or is that something that somebody has to go out and contract for to get that kind of more specific evaluation?
Mr. Chair, the pesticide use reporting system would not address any of those types of concerns.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, have you heard of what I've described happening?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I have. That's a function that Oregon State University, as well as private consultants, do. Field representatives for the various food processors, they are involved in this kind of activity of actually going on site and working with the growers to identify their pest situations and work with them to determine the best means to control those pests.
Yeah, and the motivation, of course, on the part of a grower would be, gee, if I don't have to spend $50,000 extra on the pesticide and you get the same result, it's a smart thing to do for my bottom line. But that's private consulting totally. There would be no interface at all between this and that.
Mr. Chairman, I think there is the potential for that, but the generalities that we're working with, for example, we are required to capture the purpose for the application, but because of concerns about confidentiality, we have rolled that up to a high level, for example, insecticide rather than cherry fruit fly as being the identification for the purpose of the application. So I think the researchers at Oregon State University who are working with growers will be very interested in our information, but again, the less specific it is, the more general it is, the greater limitations we have for filling their research needs.
Some months down the road, we might be interested in talking to researchers at OSU about that dimension of this whole thing. Senator Nelson has a question.
And just a question and a comment. I mean, a lot of this looks to me like a solution looking for a problem. And that's what I've always felt about the Pesticide Use Reporting Act. I mean, the data's going to be fine. You've got to get some data at some particular point. Year after year, I think the data is going to be pretty much the same. As just the chair's comment about growers, I mean, when most of these guys, at least the farmers that I know, when a field man comes out and says, well, I want you to put X amount of ounces or pounds on there, most farmers take like two-thirds or three-quarters of that and cut it down. Because we figure those guys are trying to make money on what we're trying to do. And so you have a pretty good feel for that, I think. I mean, it's a market-based thing that's going to go there. And it's not a question, I guess, it's just a comment that farmers have been doing a lot of this. I guess one thing I should ask Chris is that, like in my case, as a grain farmer, a lot of those pesticides are marked R for restricted. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, yes, there are certain products that are classified restricted use and therefore have their distribution limited to specific individuals.
And that's most of the things, at least as a grain farmer, that I use are usually an R marked on them. And so in order for me as a farmer to do that, I have to take a test. Isn't that correct? To get my pesticide application license.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, that's correct. For a farmer or his employees to use restricted use materials, they need to be especially licensed by the department, and that's as a private pesticide applicator. And that's actually in agreement with federal law.
Yeah, I mean, so we've got all these laws. We've got a lot of regulations. That's the point I'm driving to. We've got a lot of regulations as far as farmers' use of pesticides. I mean, it's not as though we're out there willy-nilly doing that. I look at my farm. If I have an airplane do it, he does it in less than a day. So there's one day out of 365 that I'm actually applying any herbicides or anything like that. And there may be some residual effect on it, but a lot of these pesticides now is that they break down and they're biodegradable. I mean, you know, there's so many checks and balances out there as far as pesticide use that for us as a committee to spend a lot of time on it, I can't see any value to it. But that's just my position.
Well, thank you for your opinion.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
You did say it was a solution looking for a problem. Just as long as the solution isn't DDT or something.
Never mind. That's a pun
just for you this morning.
On to Senator Bates.
This may be more of a comment than a question, too, but I just want to suggest some things, and maybe you can get back to us later about this. One of the things we were concerned about with pesticide reporting was to protect growers, agricultural people, from either perceived or real dangers to them because of the society we live in, unfortunately. I don't have that concern so much about the zip code areas you're talking about, and I know you're trying to protect them too, but frankly, I just don't share that concern. But I do have a concern, actually a big concern, about pesticide use in the public and in the areas you're talking about, zip codes and even agriculture. I think it's pretty open there. And I've had concerns about that for a long time, both as a physician and as an Oregonian. So I would caution you that I'm just going to tell you that from my point of view, trying to maintain a lot of anonymous situations there or anonymous information there, I'm not concerned about it. I want you to know that. On the agriculture side, the grower side, I do continue to have concerns. I do worry about ecoterrorists and others really causing some problems for our growers, and I do want them protected still. I would still say this is a problem in our society. About 5 years ago in the Hood River area, now, the DEQ found high quantities of pesticides in one of the streams, traced it back to a couple of growers. The growers did not know it was happening. They were as appalled as everybody else was, and they fixed this problem. The growers did not, and not just because they wanted to save money, but they didn't want pesticides in the streams either. They enjoyed the salmon in the streams just as much as we do. These are good people. None of them are out there being bad guys that I know of, and I think, Senator, you'd probably agree with that.
Yeah.
But they were surprised to find that it happened. And what they did was not only cut down what they were using, but they applied it differently at a different time of the year and were very successful in resolving the problem. But they wouldn't have known the problem was there if the EQ hadn't just been spot checking and found it. And the pesticides were affecting the growth of salmon fry at that time. I still think we need to do this. What I'm hoping is there will be a feedback loop somewhere along the line. If we see even these very high levels as far as reporting is concerned, signaling more pesticide use taking place than we expect, then we get back to the growers, back to their associations. I read the Capital Press all the time. These are good people. They do the best they can.
and they need information, but they need to be protected too. But I think there's room for compromise here that will help everybody, and hopefully that's what the program will do.
Senator Bates, I want to thank you for that comment. It seems to me that one of the uses of this whole project, if nothing else, is a consciousness-raising effort on everybody's part, statewide. And it can't have anything but a positive benefit at that level. It just raises people's consciousness of the whole issue.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, if I could just respond briefly to your comments, and I appreciate your comments. Much the data points that are set forth in the pesticide use reporting system are very limited. And so even with some of the concerns that you bring up, I don't believe that this system will address those. I think there still will be need for ongoing monitoring of waters, other things, and continuing to maintain our base pesticide program, which really is our enforcement tool that assures through audits and complaints that we investigate and assure pesticide users are using those products appropriately. And I think we have had a history of a very strong base pesticide program here in Oregon. So the system ultimately, unfortunately, really is limited in terms with the changes in the law. And I understand about the urban uses too, but the language is pretty specific in Senate Bill 290 about what the department shall not do. And we are very cognizant of that.
Senator Nelson? Just another real-world application. It's basically, I think, and I think this is right, an applicator is under a strict liability standard of care in the world of law. So if I, as an applicator, go out and do it wrong, I'm strictly liable. I mean, that's the real world. There's a lot of checks and balances, is what I'm saying. I think this is fine and wonderful to have all this information, but, I mean, okay, what do we fund education or do we fund the reporting system? I mean, that's my idea of it.
Thank you. Senator Nasser, could you have a question?
I have a question.
Okay. Cool. As versus a commentary? Go ahead.
I just haven't been involved with this program hardly at all. And I'm wondering, is there definitive, and maybe Dr. Bates knows the answer to this, research in terms of deleterious effects on human health of pesticides? Do we know? Do we have any research or data that allows us to make a decision, or are we still waiting? Or
may I answer as best I can?
Sure.
And this is just family doc from Southern Oregon, okay? I read as much of this as I can. We have a lot of good research done by the companies themselves, and as far as short term is concerned, we're pretty certain these things are safe. And they are used carefully in a restricted fashion. Long term effects, we really don't know for sure. We know their cancer rates are up in this country, over third world countries significantly. We don't know why, and we are looking at lots of things that could be causing it. Remember, the physicians are handing out every day to their patients, self-included, to pesticides, to herbicides, to pollutants in the air from heavy metals and industry. So you can't
McDonald's hamburgers,
and so you can't point a finger at anybody right now. But we know something's going on, and we know that we're looking long-term stuff, trying to figure out why this is happening. I mean, one of the big fields is in reproductive health right now. We are very concerned about levels of sterility showing up in first world countries. That is being caused by something in our environment that's not happening elsewhere. So those issues are all being looked at and talked about. There are long-term studies. It'll be a while before we have any answers. I think the prudent thing we do now is to be careful of what we're doing. Don't throw the baby out the bathwater. Let's not get rid of pesticides. You know, let's continue to use them, but be careful with them and continue to be cautious with them.
Dr. Bates, I just want to follow up on that. I lack objectivity at a certain level, and that's because my wife's family comes from Mississippi and Arkansas. And my wife's stepmother's part, her family, her entire family, grew up in the cotton fields. And they just kind of take it as almost biblical truth. Nobody lives past 65. They've all died of cancer. And right now, my stepmother-in-law is going into chemotherapy around this thing. She's the only one left in the family with a lot of kids and aunts and uncles. And so they've just been saying, well, it's from the cotton fields and the pesticides, and just like it was biblical truth. And what I'm here, and I've accepted that for years. What I'm saying here is that they were saying that just out of their family experience, but don't have any scientific.
It's very anecdotal, and I have empathy for those people, but you can't, scientifically, you can't say it's true.
Yeah.
It may be something entirely different. I mean, as an example, how much do they smoke? How much alcohol do they consume? Are they overweight? How much exercise do they get? Obviously, a lot. Okay.
They have a lot of exercise in cotton fields.
So you can't, there's nothing you can pin down and say that. So you have to be very careful with this kind of stuff and not just draw your personal experiences from it, which we all have a tendency to do, myself included.
Yeah. And whole cultures, whole little towns can come to a wrong conclusion out of that experience.
Be careful.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Senator Shields, just as a follow-up to Senator Deckert's question, as a point of information, there is an extensive process through the Environmental Protection Agency to register and re-register a pesticide. This is a highly regulated industry. There are highly regulated products, and there's extensive research done on them to look at a multitude of issues before they're ever put on the market. And just to add on to that, The most toxic pesticides require a license to be able to purchase them or use them.
Is somebody's cell phone feeding back through the system? That happened the other day in a hearing on Wednesday in the Revenue Committee, remember? Mm-hmm. Yes. So, thank you for your answers. This has been very helpful, very informative for me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair. On to Senator Deckert's question about data and on health effects. Do we still run the PART program in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Senator Barry, yes, the PART program was refunded by the 2005 legislative session. It's up and running and fully functional. We've had several large cases go through it since the close of session.
You may want to explain what that is to Senator Deckert. I do have another question. Chris, you said that we are required to capture the purpose of application of pesticides. Is that required by the ORS or by the OAR?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer, I'm not sure I understand your question.
You made the statement that we are required to capture the purpose of the application. Is that ORS or is that OAR?
That's statute.
Okay.
Do you want to respond to Senator Deckert?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, Senator Deckert. Just as a follow-up, the PARC program is the Pesticide Analytical Response Center. And it is a consortium of agencies put together to take in cases of potential pesticide poisoning, evaluate those cases, and to determine if pesticides may have been the cause or not in many situations. Chris, do you want to follow up with that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckert, since PARC has now refunded the agency, has revitalized that. I'm currently serving as the administrator of PARC. We have actually entered into cooperative agreements with the member agencies, including Health Services, which does provide some funding for the work that they do, and Oregon State University for their both environmental toxicological work as well as human toxicological work. PARC is up and running again. Thanks to the actions of the 2005 legislature.
Just as a follow-up, I guess, and maybe too early to know, but I know that in the past, prior to PARC being unfunded, I don't know if I can say most, but many cases of suspected pesticide poisoning were found out not to be by PARC, and I don't know if you have any data from the past 6 months while you've been funded or not to tell us what percentage of, when people report a pesticide poisoning, it instantly goes to this PARC process, and the percentage of those that are truly pesticide poisoning or not.
Mr. Chair, Senator Barr, we are gathering that sort of data. We are required to prepare an annual report. And so I would foresee probably in July of 2007 we'll be able to put together a 12-month worth of data report. There are not a lot of park cases that have come in, but certainly we have had two human fatalities associated with pesticide usage that we've had to deal with, as well as some environmental contamination. So there are some very serious cases that we've dealt with since park has been revitalized. And certainly in the human fatalities, one was not associated, we found was not associated at all with pesticide usage. The other did have some association. So again, we're dealing with a number of different situations. It's almost a case-by-case sort of thing, and that information will be available on our annual report.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just to follow up on these fatalities used within the last 6 months, or was this prior to the, I mean, was that the, of all the park reports you had, even part of the time you were not funded?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, what I'm talking about is since park was refunded, we've had two cases where pesticides were questioned as being associated with the fatalities.
Okay, just to comment, I remember in our committee meeting last time that the last time park was in operation, you had two fatalities. One was from a guy who drank a bottle of pesticides, a full bottle, because he wanted to commit suicide, and the other one was because it was a spray pilot and he slammed into a telephone pole.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, yes, historically we've had a number of different kinds of cases. These are both interior applications that had family members involved.
If there aren't any other questions, we're running up against time crunch here. Thank you for being patient and going a lot longer than we said you'd go.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask Paul Bell if he'll come up. This will be a much shorter report. There's not as much to say. It's Forest Legacy Review. Of course, this is a limited program. It has to do with inside urban growth boundaries. I think we'll spend 10 or 15 minutes on this.
I'll be here.
Thank you. Quick. Welcome. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you. Chair Shields and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide information on the Forest Legacy Program. For the record, I'm Paul Bell with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I'm the program director for our private lands program. The Federal Forest Legacy Program provides funding to nationally selected projects that protect key forest types that could be converted to other uses. Senate Bill 496, adopted by the 2005 legislature, authorized the Department of Forestry to participate in the Legacy Program within urban growth boundaries. Authorization to proceed with the program came late in the federal fiscal year 07 project selection cycle, with an annual closing date for the state to submit projects of November 30th. Working with the Forest Service, the department was able to use an abbreviated process to solicit and rank and submit legislative project proposals for that budget cycle. The department sent solicitation letters to cities, local land trusts, and conservation groups on September 9th, with a deadline for submittal of October 31st. So out of that solicitation, the department received two projects, one from the city of Eugene and one from the city of Portland. And I've provided you handouts with descriptions of both of those projects. The projects were evaluated and ranked by for state priority by the department with the assistance of the Oregon Forest Land Coordinating Group. This group consists of landowners, private landowners, representatives of conservation groups, and state and federal natural resource-related agencies. The state criteria that the projects were required to meet included the proposed project must meet the requirements of Senate Bill 496. All applicants' Forest Legacy Program procedures adequate to ensure compliance with statewide land use planning goals. It was the project proposed project in a state forest legacy area, and will it conserve a priority forest type as listed in Oregon's assessment of need? And these priority areas include oak woodlands, hardwood bottom lands, and ponderosa pine forest within the current assessment of needs. And then, does the proposed project adequately address the national ranking criteria? And then there are several components, a national ranking criteria such as importance, which is the public benefits gained from the protection and management of the property, criteria of threatened, which is its threat for conversion to non-forest use, and then strategic, how the project fits within a larger conservation plan strategy or initiative. And then additional criteria included, is the project ready, is the work done to get it to come into the system, how did the state rank it, and past performance of the state program. The Eugene project sought assistance with the purchase of 25 acres of oak woodlands. The Portland project sought assistance in the purchase of about 1+ acres of land adjacent to the Johnson Creek in southeast Portland. The Eugene project was ranked first, and the Portland project was ranked second by the committee. Those rankings were submitted to the Forest Service, and the Eugene project then was eventually ranked 30th in the national ranking out of 31 projects that were submitted into the president's FY07 budget. And I've provided a list for you there that shows all of the projects in the nation that come into this. Where we're at the moment is the department reconvened our coordinating group in February to sit down and establish a timeline for soliciting projects for the federal fiscal year 06 or 08 time frame. Solicitations for projects for federal fiscal year 08 will begin in this March, and then we'll close in July. And we're hoping this will provide a larger opportunity for cities to get more projects to come in, and because the last time frame was extremely short for them to get their information in and into the project. The projects, once they're submitted and ranked this fall, the projects, and those projects will then be forwarded to the Forest Service and go through the same review system for the national process. And that's what I had.
Looking at that list on the end of the handout, that's $61 million. How much of the total would they likely fund? I mean, it becomes their discretion, of course, and you don't know. But given history, do they ever get down to number 30 on the list?
They have. I mean, they have funded the total projects selected in the past. Of course, it all depends on how the budget ends up going through the congressional process. That is an issue if the budget gets reduced. Historically, they start at the bottom of the list and start reducing projects, although they have applied a percentage of reduction across projects before. So the city of Eugene could see the same amount, they could see something less, or they could be cut totally.
So instead of limiting the number of projects, they might limit the individual amount given to each of the projects. That would be their more likely way of reducing budget impacts.
I've heard both Senator
both
Fields. I've heard projects. It's probably more likely they start at the bottom and reduce up, because once they start reducing the cost, it starts affecting matches that the other programs have in place. But it has gone both ways.
Okay.
For the current president's budget is proposed, they are proposing to increase this current amount for the next fiscal by about $4.2
million. I had one other question, and this is kind of self-serving. Johnson Creek, Crystal Springs is in my district. If they don't make it 1 year to the list, do they get to apply the next year and try and be on the list?
They can apply, Senator Shields. However, a project like that ranking, we need to be realistic with that in regards to how it ranks across with the national criteria. I think that would be pretty lucky if that one ended up playing out totally across the national process.
And maybe some other time we could talk personally about why the ranking is what it is.
You bet.
I've spent a lot of time with the Johnson Creek Watershed Enhancement Council and stuff like that, and they do a fantastic job. They've got salmon back in a stream that hasn't had anything but pollution for years. And they have a huge number of volunteers that rip out invasive species and spend Saturdays planting along the stream bank and all kinds of stuff. It's an amazing watershed council. So
the
I don't know if that plays into it, how much private involvement, how much volunteer involvement are involved in projects, but money there leverages a lot of volunteer effort. That's all I know.
Yeah. Senator Shields, the amount of acres applies there becomes a priority, and you know it's kind of how big of a bang for the buck are you getting within all the systems. So, I mean, felt pretty fortunate to get the Eugene one on the list.
In other words, you're talking about the cost of land per acre, and of course, there's so many places you can do much better than in the middle of an urban area where land is at a premium. But what's happened years ago is that we paved over a lot of the watershed, and then we had some terrible floods across, you know, Foster Boulevard and a lot of other places. And they've realized that when the Army Corps of Engineers straightened out the stream years ago, they made a big mistake. They created a flood. So now they've actually gone back and taken the strait out of the stream and tried to restore its natural banks and use all kinds of natural absorption process. So it's just fascinating to me. And I'd be interested in talking to you at another time.
You bet.
But let's talk. Are there any questions that anybody has about this one? Well, if you don't have any questions, something I have to drop on you is the OSU Biofuels Research and Development folks can't be here till after lunchtime. And so we're a little bit ahead of schedule, and I don't want to violate our schedule. Therefore, I'm going to give us a break for 8 minutes. Can you guys take an 8-minute break and come back? Because I don't want to be off.
Let's just keep going to lunch.
Let's talk about some organizations.
You want to talk about, well, I guess we can start the. I just don't want to start something ahead of the time frame on here. So is it okay? We can get a cup of coffee or something.
If we want 8 minutes, we're not allowed to be back till 15.
Well, I want you back in 8. You're disciplined.
Are you sure?
Let's just stand at ease for about 6 or 8 minutes. Okay. That way. This is work plan discussion, and we do need to talk about this scheduling thing, but maybe we at least should wait until Senator Bates gets back down here. What I'm doing here is we are kind of throwing a lot of things together and trying to get input from people. I know that quite often, historically, over the years, chairs have just put together agendas. But I would like to at least have some input. Probably the most significant thing that I should have starred is other members' suggestions. The first three suggestions on this under the potential additions to the work plan actually come from Senator Ringo, who isn't here today. He is out of state, but he wanted some kind of update on mixing zones. He wanted an update on water resources issues, and he had some Department of Forestry budget review issues. And Judith, he was supposed to send an email to you. Was he able to get it? Did you check?
I did check my email. I haven't received anything from him as coming down. That's the point of coming down to the meeting here.
So I'm just saying those are things, and all I have is kind of the titles. And it is kind of like picking up stuff in the past. As chair, there's some things that I was interested in. Energy savings performance contracts is something that I've had interest in for a while. I don't know the pros and cons of it, but the idea is that when you build a building, if you can actually build into it stuff that saves energy. The best example I can give is that when you build a building, the actual building of the building is only 25% of the cost of the building for the 50-year life of the building.
Mm-hmm.
Another 25% is the energy used. The other 50% is maintenance and refixing it and refixing it and refixing it. If you do it early on, you can make a building, you can actually save 10% or 15 or 20% of what it costs to run that building through its 50-year life by doing that kind of thing. Anyway, that was my suggestion. So we've kind of ticked off several of them. But now that Senator Bates is here, let's go back a little bit and pull out our calendars. And since you were talking about those dates, where are they? Are they in front of us somewhere
Mr.
here?
Mr. Chair, on the draft work plan, you received that by email, but I also provided a hard copy at your seat. You'll see the last item is the proposed committee schedule, and we wanted to have folks check their calendars and make sure those were workable dates so we could get good participation from the committee.
Okay. And we have probably an additional meeting date that can be added if our workload requires it. Now,
today.
April 5th is not going to work for Senator Deckert, and I don't imagine it would work very well for Senator Bates, because it's not a Friday, and Senator Bates is trying to keep his Fridays open.
Plus,
right?
We have a Senate session April 6th, I believe.
Yeah, that's why we had picked the 7th originally, because we had a Senate session the day before.
We're talking the 5th or the 7th now.
Senator Deckert had raised a problem with the 7th for him, and so we thought we'd try the 5th.
You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Neither of those work for Senator Deckert. I want to, and I have a scribbled note about a caucus retreat as well. Is that true, Senator Beyer? Bates? Do you have any?
I'll tell you who's not going to that caucus retreat, and that's Roger Beyer.
You sure?
We'd love to convert him. What do you know?
Things have been changed in the Republican side. They got independents, they got all kinds. You know what's going to happen next. People keep you jumping.
Yeah, right.
There was a discussion last week about a caucus retreat, but no date was given, so we're just bouncing that around yet.
Okay.
I think that was on this. It was after a Senate session, not before.
Well, it would. It would be after a Senate session if it's like the 7th or 8th.
Yeah. 7th is a good day, I think. I mean, except for Senator Deckert.
Yeah, come.
Do you want to do it? I hate to not have Senator Deckert here. He always makes sure that I'm at his revenue committee, and I'm trying to be, you know, tough on him and make sure he's always at this committee, but... Go ahead.
Senator Deckert, are Fridays bad for you?
I'm just gone that week.
That particular Friday's bad.
It's just that particular Friday's bad. But you're not going to get,
you're going to get everybody all the time.
The following Friday, would that work for you?
The following Friday would be the 14th. And that would work for me.
Okay.
Would that work for everybody else? Roger.
I don't know.
The 14th?
Yet. Yeah, as far as I know, but I can't, you know.
What about you, Senator Bates?
Well, it's a good Friday.
What's this? It's Holy Week.
It's not a problem for me personally, but it's the beginning of spring break, so it might be difficult for some others.
Spring break.
April 7th is
the week of the 26th through the...
Is it the next week down?
No, up here.
What's this?
Spring break
is last week in March.
Okay.
Well, Good Friday doesn't bother me. Remember, I used to be a preacher, but then I traded sides.
14th okay with me.
Became a politician. Never mind.
April 7th is a better day for me. I have a meeting. I have a technology meeting on that day. On the 14th. Yeah, we're just rewriting the whole technology statute, so I'm better than that.
Okay, shall we stick at 7?
I think
okay.
7.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. Dave's pushing hard for the 7.
Okay.
April 7th.
We're back to where we started.
Okay.
And I don't think we need to necessarily fight over the other dates. They're there. The 14th.
Yeah.
Okay. David wants as many of us as can to go to Pendleton. And like I said, there'll be Salem on the 22nd and probably one additional one in there. I know we're kind of ahead of schedule, but I had asked people, and I'm just saying this generally, on my potential additions to the work plan, under the potential additions from the chairman, I have people, I'd asked if somebody would come on energy savings performance contracts, on the recycling, the revisit of Senate Bill 291, and on the number three, the academic freedom OSU handling of post-fire logging study. Who all's here from that? You guys are here on the academic freedom one. You're here on the recycling one. Is there anybody here on the energy savings?
Stephen Corey said he'd be here by 11:30, so he should be right.
Okay, I'm going to try and keep in order. You guys had to leave at what time? As soon as possible.
The latest by 1:00.
Okay.
But ideally by 12:45, 4:30.
Down there by then?
Leaving here.
Oh, leaving here. Okay, I'm going to give you guys a few minutes first, and then you guys second, and since before he gets here late, he can go third.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is this a...
These are not hearings, per se. I just want people to spend a few minutes explaining what the issue was. Okay? You follow where I am? The hearing, if we can get it scheduled, will be at a later time. And this one I know... Most of them I don't know much about. But this one I know more about because we actually had a Natural Resources Committee hearing on this one during the regular session. And Senate Bill 291 was a bill introduced by Floyd Prezansky. And I kind of like the idea, and I'll just be blunt about it. It's where these folks go into apartment rentals and businesses, I guess, and remove recyclables that would otherwise go to the landfill from dumpsters. There's problems with it, but I just want you to explain briefly what it's about, and we'll probably schedule a hearing at a later date for you guys. I'll get to you probably within the next 10 to 15 minutes. Okay, and you'll be doing the same thing, a little presentation on what it would be about.
Senator Fields, committee members, my name is Jim Hoover. I own the company Waste Recovery Systems. To my right is a counselor from Cottage Grove, Lindsay Haskell. The process that we do, please feel free to interrupt me on this. I didn't prepare a statement with this, but we have a six-day service that comes in and cleans and maintains the garbage areas. We come in, we actually go into the garbage container, pull recyclables, tin, plastic, glass, these various things, and put them in the designated recycling containers that are on site. We also keep the recycling clean from contaminant where apartment complexes, tenants, contaminate the recycling by throwing garbage in the recycling, so we keep that clean on a daily basis. What we do is we actually are able to lower the garbage bill by going in and pulling the things that don't really belong there that should go to the landfill out. In the process, what I would ask of the state would be that our biggest problem has been that various cities have different interpretations of what I do, and they have some cities accept my service and some don't. When we sponsored the bill, when Senator Prezansky sponsored the bill for us, Senate Bill 291, we found that, you know, Eugene, Springfield, and these various cities accept us, some cities don't. And without me going into that whole litmus of why they don't accept me, I don't think that would be productive in the meeting.
And in fact, we will probably hear from those folks in a hearing context. Okay. A quick question. I'd like to know from Cottage Grove what your perspective is.
Well, usually, thank you, Senator Shields and members. I'm usually up here advocating for local control and don't interfere with city business. But I'm kind of green on at this, and I kind of come from the heart on what we're doing to our landfills and what we've been doing for 50 years and why we should stop. But really, lately, and you'll really notice it, and I've noticed it, that cities and counties are taking it upon themselves if the state doesn't take action. They do.
Mm-hmm.
And so the minute you cross that indivisible line, there's a new set of parameters and guidelines and laws that you have to obey. So I'm here on the other side of the issue now telling you we need to take a statewide action on this rather than have all these individual rules, especially up in your area where the lines are so close together, and in 20 minutes you can go through three jurisdictions and you have three different sets of rules.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that what's in the green monster needs to come out. I don't believe it should be in a landfill, and it's so easy to remove it at the source. We should do it. Back east, they spread it out on the grounds and spend millions of dollars poking through it, trying to get what wasn't taken care of at the site. And I think that's being proactive after the fact. I think we should be proactive and handle it ahead of time.
Okay. Does the committee have questions about generally the parameters of the bill? I mean, I understand that garbage haulers and companies have some problems because if the dumpster gets filled up and they call it away, they make some money. If it gets filled up slower because you've removed all the recycling, there may be some loss of income there, and there's also some liability questions. I understand that you're trying to deal with those liability questions. My suggestion in a hearing that we might have and a look at this recycling bill in the next session or a pre-session filing of that bill, you need to address those questions. Not today, but those questions need to be addressed. The very fact that we might have a hearing about this might be a basis on which you try to go to some folks in the major industries, the big nationwide people, and say, hey, all I'm trying to do is thus and such. Can we work out a compromise? Can we get to a yes on this issue? And so on and so forth. You know, personally, I don't like it when a dumpster gets filled up so quick that there's garbage piled all around it and all over the place, and then I look inside the dumpster and it's full of stuff that really ought to be recycled.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I see where you're coming from. Okay.
There's a lot of Senator Shields, Chairman, and committee members. There's just so much to this that I would really appreciate several meetings on this if we could have. I provided you with a packet. And
what I would suggest is make sure you provide everybody on the committee with a packet ahead of time. From your perspective, I assume the industry would probably be wanting to provide their perspective to us ahead of time, too. But I think it's a worthy agenda item, and I'm just giving the committee a heads up. I'm asking for their suggestions, so as soon as we finish hearing from folks like you guys, I'm going to ask. I'm sure Senator Nelson's got a lot of agenda items that he wants to put on the agenda. But I appreciate it. Yes.
Chairman Shields, may we supply you packets even though you don't go forward with this, just for your own information?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So
you know,
we'll get to Judith
packets. We will likely go forward with this one. It does interest me. I thought that the testimony, and it was bipartisan support for it in committee. Last time I remember both Republicans and Democrats saying positive things when you had your hearing. I just don't know kind of what happened to the bill and why.
Nobody
once
does.
That committee hearing was over. And we're all busy during the legislative session, and some things kind of get lost, excuse me for the pun, but they get lost in the rubble.
Sure.
In a situation that would be very
right.
much the case.
Thank you.
Okay. So provide as much information, be in touch with Judith, and
we'll... Floyd gave me your phone number.
Okay.
So. Thank you.
Thank you for your time. Gentlemen, you're here from academic freedom. That this handling of post logging, all that stuff, and appreciate you coming, Ralph. It's good to have you here this morning. Would you guys, for the record, introduce yourselves?
Yes.
And we'll just kind of hear the concerns you have, and again. At least a couple of us in the committee are quite concerned and would like to probably investigate this a little more than a hearing. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Shields. I brought along with me today Dominic De La Sala, and my name is Ralph Bloomers. I work on these issues in the state. I'm a public interest attorney, and Chair Shields, you indicated your interest in the goings-on at the College of Forestry recently on the controversy related to the Donato study. And so I quickly
called around to see who might be able to talk about this best, and so I was just going to turn it over to Dominic De La Sala. He can introduce himself, and okay. He's got some prepared remarks, which we'll leave copies with each one of you all.
Okay.
Dominic, welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Thank you for having me here today to address your working session. I'm actually a scientist by training, and I even did my postdoctoral research work at Oregon State University back in the 1980s and still think highly of the university and learned a lot about forest ecology in those days. And since then, I've worked mainly on forest ecosystems across the nation and most recently on disturbance ecology. I was actually on the ground during the 1988 Yellowstone fires and also covered the Biscuit Fire in 2002. As both a researcher and a conservation biologist. But I'm really here today to provide some context and background for you to consider if this goes to the direction of looking at a hearing into these matters. But specifically, a lot of this focuses on, at the federal level, the two bills that are in Congress right now, the Forest Emergency Recovery and Research Act, H.R. 4200, which was introduced by Congressman Walden and Baird, and the related Forest for Future Generations Act, which is the Senate companion bill, Senate 2079. And these companion bills have been put forward in response to recent fires and other disturbances under the auspices that recovery and restoration of these areas is needed through expedited post-fire logging and tree planting after natural disturbances. And I think while at least initially, one might think that these kinds of activities would be necessary following disturbance, there's a growing body of scientific literature that has come out over the recent decades, going back to the work that's been done on Mount St. Helens eruption in 1980, and the work on Yellowstone fires, and a lot of other science that's come out on disturbance ecology, that these systems are quite robust and are quite capable of coming back on their own. And that typically when you go in and do post-fire logging, you can impact the ecosystem and the benefits that those ecosystems provide to regeneration after disturbance. So I think it's within the scientific context of these and other scientific studies, particularly the one that was published by Dan Donato and his colleagues that got a lot of attention, that we really need to look at the full breadth of science. And the studies that have been done so far, the one that received the most interest was the one published by Donato in the journal Science, and the paper was extensively reviewed and ultimately published. And the science is really the gold standard of scientific inquiry, and it's a very tough journal to get a publication through it. In my 20-plus years, I've never gotten a publication in a science journal, and yet a graduate student who did a really great study got his in science. So it's something that definitely needs to be upheld. And particularly what this study found was that natural regeneration following the 2002 Biscuit Fire was quite prolific, and even severely burned sites, the conifers were coming back nicely on their own. And the study also found that post-fire logging had actually impacted the seedling establishment. Areas that were logged had a reduced seedling recovery rate of about 71%, and the slash that was left behind by logging actually increased fuel hazards on those areas that were logged. And particularly the burning that happened on those sites to reduce slash could also impact recovery and regeneration of those ecosystems. So I think it contributed to our understanding of how these systems come back post-fire. And the controversy really centered on how some of the professors, a group of professors and forest managers led by the College of Forestry at OSU, tried to block the publication of this study. The BLM also pulled funding for the study and then later restored it after being called on to do so by Congressman Udall and Inslee, and that triggered a field hearing. Congressman Walden then held a hearing in Medford and accused Dan Donato of failing to follow proper procedure. Congressman Baird questioned Mr. Donato on the statistical methods that he used to produce the study and repeatedly accused the student of being disingenuous. And I think that the public and many of the scientists that were at that hearing were particularly alarmed with how that
the student and that issue was treated. And I'm hoping that as chair of this committee that you will consider looking into this further, because a lot of the questions, the key questions, were not covered in that field hearing. And here's some suggestions of things to consider. One particular issue is, why didn't the College of Forestry professors that were opposed to the Donato study go through proper scientific channels to address their concerns over this particular study instead of trying to block its publication? Typically what happens in the field of science is you get a publication that's gone through peer review, it's in the literature, and if somebody doesn't like it or doesn't think the peer review is adequate, they publish a rebuttal. And science moves forward through that process. It's very healthy. It happens all the time. But in this case, it was different because a group of nine forest managers and professors from the college tried to block the publication when it was already scheduled for publication in Science. That's very unusual.
You're saying it was already scheduled for publication? Okay.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
How did they try to block it?
They sent a letter to the editor of Science saying that peer review process that the study had gone through failed to address issues. And the editor of Science wrote back and said that it did go through rigorous peer review and that it seemed that the professors were politically motivated in trying to block the study.
So they sent a letter to the editor of the and asked that it not be published?
Right. And that's normally not done?
That, to my knowledge, that's not typically how the academic issues are handled when you publish an article in a scientific journal. I'm not aware of any examples where that's happened in my 20-plus years.
Okay.
So a couple other questions. Why did the College of Forestry professors release their own study to the Forest Service back in July of 2003, so-called Sessions Report, that did not go through a similar rigorous peer review process, including an ecological review, yet that study by Sessions was used to promote the highly controversial biscuit logging project that you've heard a lot about? Forest Service was actually had a draft environmental impact statement ready to go to the printers, and it did not involve the controversy that ensued until they got this peer-reviewed study from John Sessions and colleague, and that moved the goalpost. And then we were looking at one of the largest timber sales in on federal lands in recent memory. That paper did not go through the peer review process.
Why not?
I'm not sure.
Isn't it procedure to have stuff go through peer review?
Well, they did what's called a white paper, and typically white paper is the gray literature in science, and it doesn't go through the rigorous peer review process that, you know, something that gets published in the journal does. And I think the important issue there is that white paper influenced public policy with little, if any, ecological review.
Okay.
And so I think it really led to a double standard that came out of the college. On the one hand, they were silent on the Sessions report, and on the other hand, at least initially, Dean Salwasser was very critical of the Donato study. And I think that's something that needs to be addressed. And also, there are other ramifications of Dean Salwasser's instructions to the faculty to support, quote, this is in their budget document, support for increasing harvest tax rate will depend on how forest land owners perceive value returned by the college programs, hence our need to make sure our programs are aligned with their needs and that they know that what we are delivering. And that, to me, reflects a conflict of interest. It's very difficult to me to understand how the college could be neutral and unbiased on issues of logging when they're trying to cater to their clientele base.
Okay.
So I think there's a number of questions.
Yeah. Let me say that this is not the hearing.
Right.
Okay. So let's make sure that everybody's aware that there will be a hearing. I've already talked to OSU about the possibility of this hearing. We've had some very calm, civilized, you know, conversations about this. So what I want you to do is sum up as quickly as you can. You're making... I want to just make sure that we don't make accusations. I realize that last week there were accusations made at Donato, finger-pointing. I don't want to repeat finger-pointing here. Okay?
Sure.
Okay, so I think just to kind of wrap up on this, I think it would be great if the committee could look into how the college handled the Donato study versus how they handled the Session study. And I also think that it would really be helpful to the public to open the discussion beyond the Donato study. And from the hearing last Friday in Medford, the members of Congress gave the impression that all we have out there is the Donato study, and there's a bigger body of scientific evidence about the damaging effects of post-fire logging that did not get covered in that hearing. That would be beneficial to have that discussion as you proceed with this.
Okay. As I said while you're out of the room, Senator Nelson, I'm not wanting finger-pointing here.
I resent that.
Feel like we have to have a calm, as objective as possible kind of discussion. I'm concerned with the accusations I've heard, but I did call OSU, had conversations. They're fully aware that this may be an agenda item. They have talked to Dean Salwasser about coming and giving his side of the story. This is my purpose, whether talking to you or the folks that came from the recycling or Mr. Kafori in a few minutes, was to give the committee some background on why we would hold the hearing. Do any of you have any questions, or did you have some concluding remarks that you wanted to make?
No, I think that's pretty much it.
Okay. Well, I appreciate what you're doing, because this is an important subject, and I particularly... You know, I was down in Ashland last weekend and was kind of listening as I came and went to what was going on in Medford, and I was concerned about the objectivity of that particular hearing. But, you know, I don't want us to have anything that's not objective any more than what happened last week, you know, may or may not have been objective. I would like to try to have some balance to this whole thing. Go ahead.
Just a couple comments.
Senator Bates.
Just a couple comments real quick. Unfortunately, I was, as I rarely am, was out of town last Friday in Medford, and we have a quiet little town down there, and something hot was going on, and I missed it. I'm sorry I did. There's really two issues here for me. One is academic freedom, which to a certain degree is not the purview of this
yeah.
committee. Academic freedom issues should be resolved in a different area. And I think there is questions of academic freedom here. But if you want to talk about how we manage our forests, that's a different story. I can actually perceive or see a way in which you'd say, we're going to go in and log after a burn. We know that the effect of that logging is going to delay ecological recovery for 2 or 3 years, but the financial benefit to our community is such that we're willing to pay that price. And so just by the idea that logging a small percentage of that burn, which I think was a very small percentage, may well or may not have slowed ecological recovery, is not per se an argument for me about what the policy should be. And that's why a white paper to me has a lot of meaning. You know, what is short-term best for our environment is important. What's important for our industries and our citizens is also important. We have to always balance those two, and sometimes it's difficult to do. That's the discussion I like to have.
Mm-hmm.
Not one about who said what to who and finger pointing about academic freedoms, but what we're going to do after forest burns. I am very concerned the way we're managing our federal forests in the state right now are setting us up for some huge burns.
Mm-hmm.
We're logging at less than 10% of sustainable growth in those forests. The amount of fire potential is building, and we're probably going to have to face some decisions on this in the next few years. We're having a very nice wet winter. Can't always count on that. We get into a good forest fire season in the next year or two, and we have some huge burns in the state, some big burns in the state. We're going to have to be ready to make some decisions about what do we want to do after those burns. Do we leave them alone? Do we log certain percentages of them? Do we pay that price for doing it? Those are policy decisions, and I think that's something we should have a discussion on here.
Well, see, this is helpful to me, because we're getting this all out on the table ahead of time. I know that Senator Ringo wanted to be here today and couldn't, because he had some perspectives on this as well. I'm taking as much information as I can. I understand what you just said, Senator Bates. In this particular case, it's pretty hard to untangle these two tar babies from one another.
They get stuck together pretty good.
Because they've been stuck together, and I'm concerned, and that's why we will have folks from OSU here just assuring us that they're doing the best they can, you know, and they may be rebutted very successfully. If not, people can end up getting sued, which happens with regularity in this industry. So all I'm saying is I hope that we can shed a little more light, not heat, on the issue. We've had plenty of heat already. But it's not going away very quickly. And it does affect us. We as a Natural Resources Oversight Committee, have a lot that relates to the forest, the state forest, and the state forester and so on. They're trying to have more and more a give and take, an impact on what the feds do. So all of this is kind of intermeshed. And it's hard to separate one thing from another, so let's just try and give them as much guidance as we can. And I don't think we will speak with one voice, obviously, but I don't think that the open, honest dialogue in this committee will hurt them any either. So are there other questions that any of you would think? If not, I'm going to let you guys step back.
Thank you.
Thank you
for your time.
Yeah. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, and it was just intended to provide the information and what you all might consider putting in a hearing. That was the intent, as you requested.
Not a problem. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Mr. Kafori, this one may not be, as was just pointed out to me, under the purview of this committee. I hadn't thought so much about the committee and its purview. It may or may not, it seems. But energy savings is certainly something that somehow comes within the context of a biofuels committee that I was in charge of until it got rearranged. Because if you're saving energy, you're cutting down on what you need in terms of the fuel to make the energy in the first place. So can you give us a little bit of background on an idea that you have, Mr. Kafori?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be before you this morning. What we have in general is to talk about some of this good news that is non-controversial, and I think it's more the good news, it's great news, and everybody agrees that it's great news. I brought with me today my client, David Bell with Johnson Controls. We're going to talk about the thing called an energy savings performance contract. And I will talk just very, very briefly about some minor tweaking of the law that we may ask you for, and I'll talk about that when it comes to my turn. First of all, I'd like to introduce David Bell.
Yeah, we've got about 15 minutes.
Probably won't be that long, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I thought I would give you a little bit of background. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm David Bell. I'm with Johnson Controls. And I thought what I would do is I'd give you a little bit of background as to what performance contracting is, the role that it's currently playing in the government here today. And we'll probably talk a little bit about some of the various changes we think might help the state of Oregon in saving both energy and money along the way. Performance contracting is really a method by which cities, counties, really any organization can retrofit their infrastructure, can improve their infrastructure, can increase the efficiency of their assets while at the same time reducing the cost of their operations. And we're seeing this more and more in cities and in county government where their infrastructures have deteriorated over a few years and maybe they've got some issues with deferred maintenance. In general, we can find places where there are inefficiencies that with different sorts of retrofits we can do either better work or the same work at less energy and less cost. Energy performance contractors such as my organization, there are a number of them here in the state, some 20 or 30, what we typically do is we'll go into these locations and we'll assess where these places are at in terms of energy consumption. We may look at, let's say, buildings. We might look at streetlights, water meters, anything that consumes energy or natural resources, where over time they may be just deteriorating and costing more than they're probably worth. And then after an analysis, we can figure out, well, what's it going to take to make that efficient, sustainable, green, and something that we can guarantee will stay in that line for a number of years. And generally what we find in projects is that the amount that we can recover in terms of lost energy or lost natural resources is more than enough to pay for a debt service. Typically, and I think probably one of the reasons these projects work so well, is that they're funded not through the general fund. They're funded through a third-party mechanism, whether it's an operating lease or municipal lease or something like that. And what we can find is that the value of what we can save is greater than that obligation per year. And so the net of the whole thing is that cities or counties are able to improve their infrastructure in a rather wide-sweeping manner and not only pay for the debt service that they would incur on an annual basis, but also realize some 15 to 25% of their operating budget retained. And that's of particular value to folks who are such as yourselves are you know need to appease the taxpayers out there, because as you know, in many places in the state, public funds are not available to keep, let's say, library hours open or to maintain some of the social services that we've had in previous years. And so a mechanism like this that actually feeds revenue back into the city or the county or whomever it might be has an awful lot of play in different actually non-energy related areas. So the impact is rather wide sweeping, and the projects tend to be as well. Oh yeah, well, probably one of the most significant parts of a performance contract in general is the guarantee. The reason that this is significant is that ESCOs, energy service companies such as myself and many others in the state, once we've done the audit and we realize that there are offsets here, and we can figure out what these retrofits might look like, what they might cost, the guarantee that those function at a certain level is a very significant part of the performance contract. The sustainable level is guaranteed for sometimes 10, 20 years. In particular, I'm working with an organization in the Portland area where we've done a new building for them, and it happens to be a LEED certified building. I don't know how many of you know what LEED is. It comes from the U.S. Green Building Council, which is out of Washington, D.C., and it stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. And what it's come to be is a standard of sustainability here, and it's got a lot of public power and speaks to the administration's goal of sustainability and saving cost and money. And in this particular case, my organization is guaranteeing that the energy consumption of this building maintains at that sustainable level for 20 years. And if you consider for a second that, you know, in general, after, let's say, 5 or 6, sometimes 7 years, the cost of operations tends to increase quite significantly, and not just in running the place, but sometimes repair and replacement of major parts of your building or your infrastructure, to have a third party that guarantees that all that stuff performs, and if it doesn't, incurs the cost of either fixing it or making the city or the county whole, the aversion of risk is quite significant. And so we're seeing that performance contracting is beginning to gain some significant ground here in the state of Oregon, obviously because we have cities that have suffered from a lack of funding to really adequately repair their cities or their counties in one place or another, and the accumulation of that has begun to cost them more than the systems are probably worth to begin with. So we're finding places where these have great appeal and great value.
Let me try something that would take maybe 1 minute to make this a little more real. And tell me how far off the beam I am. When I was in Ashland last weekend coming home, I stopped to visit an old friend of mine who's a professor at the community college in Roseburg. What's the name of the community college?
Umpqua.
Umpqua. We got to talking, and I've been on the board at Mount Hood Community College.
Mm-hmm.
If we would, in his institution, say, try to get an energy savings performance contract concept going, they might replace a lot of old infrastructure, save a lot of energy, and the actual savings to that college would pay the debt service on all the new stuff that they put in. pay the debt service, pay you guys back, and they'd still have money to save over the old energy bill they were paying before.
Yes, that's
essentially the way it would work.
Thank you, Senator Shields. Yes, that's precisely how it works. Generally, the cost of the contract, the fees that we make, and I say we in terms of my industry in general, come at the front end of it. There's not a residual that applies on an ongoing basis. The reason that this is such a neat project, type of project for most organizations, is that it is our goal to find the most amount of money out there that can be redistributed back within the organization, whether it's a college or a city or a county. So we look for, I mean, it could be lighting, it could be HVAC, it could be, I mean, anything that that would pay for itself and then some. And so the motivation of energy savings contracting groups is a perfect one, I think, for this area. And in your situation, as you described it, all of the savings, all of the energy savings would go back within the organization. And what we typically see, again, is beyond the obligation to the debt service, if
for
you look at
the infrastructure that was built.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
If you consider the total amount of budget money that is allocated to operations and maintenance, what we typically find is that you can figure about 15 to 25% of that is no longer needed to be applied in that area, and it's just money that has not been spent and can be applied in other areas as the organization allows.
Okay. Real quick, Steve, you said you were going to talk about something.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, there's a couple of reasons we wanted to be here. One is that although this has been around for a couple of years, not very many people know about it, and it's been very difficult for us to get the word passed, as you know, dealing with governments. People are used to doing the same way things in the same way that they've done in the past, and it's get difficult to get people head around something that's it's a really big concept and new. Just a couple of weeks ago, we participated in a new project, new initiative in Portland called the Energy or Sustainable Schools Initiative, and I had people from business and people from government and the Department of Energy and all kinds of folks there, and they had this long, long list of things that schools could do to make themselves more energy sustainable. Never in there was it once mentioned energy savings performance contract, which could save as much money totally as much energy as all this long list of things. People just don't know about it. There is a definition in the statutes. It's ORS 279A.010 sub 1 sub G. It's fairly short, and the reason it's in there... Did you get it?
Yeah, she got it. She was fast.
The reason it's in there is because energy savings performance contracts are exempt from competitive bidding law and the construction contracting law. The reason is for this is, this was just passed in the 2003 session, that it's important to get these things going quickly and smoothly, and it's a complex problem. It's not something you can bid out, because every different company would have a different view of which things they could save money on for a local government or a state agency, and every state agency will have a little different view of what it is that they want, and so it's best done through a negotiated fee basis. The definition is fairly limited, and we want to talk about expanding that definition, and that's something we'd like to come back to you in the interim sometime if you're interested in working on this issue.
This is a fascinating concept to me. Anytime you save energy, like especially as a community college director, I want to save energy costs at my institution every time I get a chance. The question is whether it does fit here. That's something that jarred my brain when Senator Bates made his comment. You've educated us on the issue, and I appreciate that, whether it ends up in this committee or another committee or whether we can... Yeah, it is alternative energy, so it may fit in this committee, you know. Senator Nelson, whose wisdom I never argue with, says he thinks it does, so maybe we can proceed. And I guess real quick, are there questions that you would have? Anybody?
I want some business cards.
Huh?
I want some business cards.
He wants some business cards. That's beyond the committee's purview at the moment. Any questions?
I guess this one.
Yeah.
I mean, are you sort of anticipating or looking at a mandate? I mean, the cities and counties just go wild when you start changing these performance contracts. Is there, how do you guys perceive that working out? I mean, you're going to have to work with cities and counties to say, okay, if you're going to be mandated to do this.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, we're not looking at mandates. I don't think that pushing people in government works very well. People tend to get their backs up pretty quickly. What we're looking at is expanding the definition, making it easier for this to happen, streamlining the structure. And this is something we're talking to the governor's office about. This. The governor's office is very interested as well. Okay. And we've talked to some state agencies.
Okay. Great. We actually have 9 minutes before our official lunch break, and I want to get back to the important thing. I want to thank you. And we're only going to be 9 minutes before we break, so maybe you'll hang around and give him some cards. But I want other members' suggestions. That's what this whole work plan discussion was about. I got mine laid out here. Some others that Senator Ringo mentioned are laid out here. What ones do you have? Other agenda items that you might
Mr.
be
Chair,
interested in?
Yes. You're just going to throw things on here and they're going to stick and we're going to hold a hearing on them? Or I'm kind of curious.
No, they might not all stick. You're right.
Specifically on the mixing zones, we had multiple bills in the last session. None of them passed. One of them was in Senator Ringo, at least one of them was in Senator Ringo's committee. It never came out of committee. Many of you, along with myself, may be on a committee or a work group with DEQ already working on the issue.
Right.
I guess I'm curious to know that one specifically. It sounds like a duplication of effort to start something at this point in time, this committee. Also, on Department of Forestry budget review, I don't know how many people are familiar with the Department of Forestry budget and how it is built. But right now, around the state, there are, I don't know how many he could tell us for sure the exact number, but there are associations that review the Forestry Department budget at the district level and set the district level budgets. I am on one of those associations. We meet, I believe it's next week, to do our budgeting process. So the Department of Forestry is probably at least when you get to the district level, it's a budget that is more fully vetted by citizens of the state than any other state budget we have.
Let me make a comment on that. When Senator Ringo contacted me about these three items, I asked him to send an email to Judith to give more of his rationale. He apparently didn't have time to do it.
I'll check it once again.
And she will check it once again, but if he didn't have it by this morning, I doubt that he has it by noon. So I don't have his rationale on any of those, so I'm not guaranteeing that anything sticks, okay? It's just that I was laying them out because somebody mentioned them to me. Right now I'm wanting to get any suggestions you have, or Senator Bates, Senator Nelson, go ahead. Senator Bates had his hand up, and then we'll go to Senator Nelson.
In the last 3 months of the Natural Resources Subcommittee on Ways and Means, we were trying to get an understanding of all these overlapping agencies as far as how it really affected some of our environmental issues, whether it would be mixing zones or pesticide use reporting, various forms. Basically, we were talking about water quality. And as we talked to different agencies and as we talked to different members at times, so much of it was political you couldn't get a good handle on anything. And it was just something that to me seemed to be Byzantine, confused, and something as I worked through that as chair, I never got some good answers for. I sat down with some people from AOI, I talked to some people from some of our big logging firms and from our processors. And they felt kind of the same way. They didn't have good information. They felt that there were sort of targets being picked that may or may not have significance, really. There were worries that municipalities were a bigger problem than pulp mills, as an example. And we really don't know. And we focus on things like mixing zones and pesticide use reporting, and no one seems to put it together. What I did find as we went through this, there was one agency that everyone seemed to agree that they had some confidence in, and surprisingly that was DEQ, both business and environmentalists. I asked DEQ at the end of session to put together what they would see as a comprehensive plan for monitoring the water in Oregon, not based on political motivation
what people had preconceived notions about on either side of these arguments, but what they thought from a scientific and rational point of view would be the best program. And they did that. That report is available to us. We quickly vetted that in a very superficial manner with some people from industry, and they felt comfortable with it at that time. We never brought it forward because of what was going on during the session at that time, and we just held it back, knowing
might,
that
might be worthwhile for us to
knowing that we'd have a time in the interim to really take a look at that report, see what it would do for Oregon as far as getting real information out, and that information could then hopefully drive some type of policy that would be really meaningful, fair, and be useful for both our industries and our communities. I'd like to see that brought back out, looked at. And I'd like to have a discussion of that, not just from the point of view of DEQ. They're a little nervous about this, I'll tell you. Okay?
They but have from, lots of things to be nervous
but
about.
But from the point of view of industry, of what they think of that kind of a system, a reporting system, that would be much more fair-handed and be much more scientifically based. Because the scientists in DEQ are the ones who brought this up.
Okay.
And I asked them to do it that way. I said, take off your political hats. I don't want to hear about, elections and constituencies and who's going to vote for this and that. Let's get some solid information.
Okay.
And they put that together. And I'd like to see us potentially look at that.
Okay. Any other suggestions?
If we just looked at that, I'd be happy.
Okay.
That's big enough.
Senator Nelson, you've been waving a flag over here.
Okay. I think we need to look at the issue of the use of Columbia River water. The state of Washington in their last session just 2 or 3 weeks ago actually have passed a bill, passed almost unanimous in both parties. The governor signed it, allowing withdrawal of water from the Columbia River for use both by fish and by environmentalists. Oregon, we don't have any.
Are they increasing their percentage? Are you saying our percentage?
They're going to take more, basically, out of this.
Okay.
They worked with the environmental groups and tribes, and not everybody's completely happy, but by and large, they passed it on a bipartisan basis. And, if we in Oregon, and I represent that part of the district, my farmers look across the river and say,
but are using that water fast?
The wineries are going in over there, industry, and if we're looking at what I think is the real big issue, the system. Well, if you start with the premise that the system needs more money, how are we going to get there?
Mm-hmm.
And if you talk with Paul Warner, he will tell you that in the last downturn, the states west of the Mississippi that actually came through the downturn in pretty good shape had an effect of severance tax on use of natural resources. Alaska being the largest example. No income tax, no sales tax, $1.6 billion surplus, and all that stuff. So they take a little bit out of each gallon of oil that comes out of there.
They got oil.
They got oil. And so Montana's the same way. Wyoming, there's a few other states like that. So what does Oregon have? Well, we have water from the Columbia River, which we use less than one-third of, or about one, less than one-half of 1%.
Yeah, as opposed to the percentage in Washington and Idaho, which are both much larger than our percentage.
Well, we're only taking about 7 or 8% of the water out of the Columbia River.
And collectively or just in
That's all the states. About 4% in Idaho, maybe not quite 3% in Washington.
Is there anybody that can give an accurate guess as to what percentage is enough, what's too much? I mean, when you talk about the Colorado River, when it gets to the end, there isn't any water left.
Let me tell you the fact of the Colorado River. Colorado River is allocated about 6 million acre feet, 7 million acre feet, someplace in that. The volume of the mouth of the Columbia River is 200 million acre feet. And if you want to get to the extreme, you can solve their problem. But I'm just worried about Oregon.
Yeah, you're not worried about that.
I'm just worried about Oregon.
Okay, all I'm saying is the comparison still stands up in that at some point it's too much. I don't know what that some point is. Right now it seems maybe there's room to use more. Washington certainly thinks so. Yeah. We just need data, and where do we get that data?
The Department of Water Resources. In fact, I have something from Paul Clary that I can give to you.
Well, water resources issues.
Yeah, I mean
that comes under that heading, maybe.
Yeah.
We can make sure it does as you talk with Judith.
Sure, I appreciate that.
Well, we want to know what Washington did. I mean, that would be the key for us.
Tell us what Washington did.
They've done the work.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I read a long article on this too. It's in the Capital Press, probably the same place he read it. And it was a compromise they've been working on for 15 years.
Okay.
It was a real battle to get it through. And they must have done the science.
Some work.
To get that done. Yeah, they just put it through, and it was. There's still some controversy involved on it, but look at the government's going to sign, it's going to go through.
Senator Bynum, do you have suggestions?
I guess underwater resources issue, I would probably have a different idea than Senator Ringo does, but I think we need to discuss more upstream storage.
Upstream storage. I've thought about that.
Mr. Chair, excuse me. But that's actually part of the Washington bill. Is their proposal is to create upstream storage reservoir sites, and then taking the water basically in the wintertime when the salmon aren't running, and then releasing it in the other times of the year. And I think it's two-thirds for human use, one-third for fish use. I think that's the...
It was something like that.
It's two-thirds, one-third, somewhere in another line.
And it was... When I read about it, we probably read the same article. It looked like everyone was pretty unhappy with it, so I think it was probably a pretty good compromise. But the problem was they've been litigating this stuff and fighting over this stuff for 15 years and never reaching resolution, so nothing was being done.
These issues reach out in every direction. Yeah. I mean, you can even throw in OSU's study of juniper, which soak up so much water that streams that were once annual streams become seasonal streams because they're just sponges out there and they even kill the plain grasses. So there's all kinds of variations on the theme.
That's a good topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Take a look at it.
Yeah. Well, listen, can we still make it back here by about 1:15 after our lunch break? If so, we'll be in recess till then. Is the room going to be locked up so it's secure?
That's right.
Okay, I'm going to leave my junk.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
I've got a
Natural Resources and Alternative Energy back to order. Something that I'm looking forward to, the OSU Biofuels Research and Development Microtechnology and Nanoscience in Biodiesel Production presentation. Dean Ron Adams and Professor Goran, it may take me half an hour to say this, Ivanovich. Did I hear that right?
Well, yeah,
Professor,
you did pretty good justice.
You did pretty good justice. Okie dokie. Well, come on up and let's start. I hope that we don't have to repeat anything for the those that are tardy in arrival. I hope you're listening.
I'm Ron Adams. I'm Dean of Engineering at Oregon State University. And Senator Shields, the chair, and also other members of the committee here, what you're going to see is a report about a project that is part of, I think, if you, as you heard previously, a larger program in biofuels underway at Oregon State. So this is one project. We don't want to leave you the impression that's the only thing happening. There are many things. The other characteristic of this project is also one of the examples we have of the impact of your investment in NAMI. In fact, this is one of the key projects under that collaboration involving the University of Oregon, Oregon State, Portland State, and Pacific Northwest National Labs. So those are the two things I wanted you to be aware of. And also, just to let you know that what you're going to see is pretty exciting, and it is an idea. It requires some more work before it will be commercially ready, but as we go through this, you'll see what that also looks like. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Ivanovich.
I'm also very happy to be here today. This is my first visit in this official capacity here, and I would like you to know that I am not representing only myself here, but several of my colleagues who work with me on this, as well as a whole group of people associated with College of Engineering and Onami Institute at OSU. So, our talk today is related to biodiesel production in somewhat new technology that came out of Onami Center, where we have all of the machinery and everything that we need to produce this kind of thing. I will start with the my disbelief that I could ever put these two people at the same slide, and they do agree on a single thing today, that we need new sources of energy, and that's probably as far as they go together. On the next slide, it's just a simple sketch of how biodiesel is made with alcohol and oil. Oil being vegetable oil or animal fat, and alcohol being either methyl alcohol or ethyl alcohol. When they were put together with the catalyst, we obtain a biodiesel and glycerol. Biodiesel being a very clean version of diesel, and glycerol is also a product that's used in several industries. Mother Nature provided us with a way of obtaining oil that we use every day, and the oil that we are talking about is exactly the same oil as you would go and buy in a grocery store. So it is something that is totally benign and doesn't have anything in there that can poison or pollute or anything else.
Before I just put it that slide, I've never seen a soybean field. I had envisioned soybeans being grown in the Midwest, where it's completely flat and not a mountain anywhere within hundreds of miles. Yet you're showing. Could you tell me where that is?
This is actually northeast corner in between. Well, I wouldn't know exactly, but it's northeast of state of Oregon.
Oh.
Northeast corner of the state of Oregon?
Right.
Up in Lavalle County.
Halfway, Lavalle County.
Yep.
Up in there.
I don't vouch for that at this moment. The other slide, the next slide shows mustard seed, mustard oil, mustard seeds from which we can get oil, and that crop I am told is very good crop in the state of Oregon in this climate. Beyond the Cascades. So Mother Nature provided us with this, and on the next slide, I would like just to come back and tell you what the microtechnology is. That's really a study and development and application of devices, and when I say devices, I mean something that can produce, take energy and produce material that have functional features on the order of 1 to 100 microns. Just for your reference, a hair is about 80 to 100 microns thick. So we are talking about that level of that scale. On the next slide, I just want to point out that Mother Nature selected microscale as a principal scale at which most of the functions in our own body operate. In, for example, in lungs, we have a microscale exchange of gases. The very last picture over there is actually vascular network in kidneys. So, and they're also made on very, very small scale of about 100 microns. On the next slide, we outlining what is a microreactor for particularly for biodiesel production. These are really scratches on plastic sheet, and you will see in a few next slides that there isn't really any sophistication in producing them. However, there is a lot of sophistication in figuring out how to use them to be effective in what we want to do. Basically, what we do, we take a stream of oil and stream of alcohol, and we pump them into these microchannels, and as they go along the microchannels, the reaction happens. You can imagine that the molecules of these two streams get very close together, and they don't have really hard time finding each other to react. And by the time this comes out on the other end of the device, which is about this long, a foot long, we have biodiesel and glycerol. Also, it's obvious that a small microchannel can produce a tiny amount of the product, but we can easily imagine that we can put thousands and millions of these scratches on the plastic and have several of these sheets piled up on the top of each other, so we can really number up our basic unit. On the next slide, we showed the vision of this, and we actually executed this. We have a means of doing it. You see the sheets of plastics that could be very, very thin, sufficiently thin to carry on these longitudinal microchannels. Oil and alcohol come through the headers, and they're equally well distributed among all of the channels on a single plate and among all of the plates in this system. On the next slide, you can see how these things look like when we make them in the lab. You can see the holes on the top of this plastic sheet. That's where the oil comes, a small set of small holes, that's where the alcohol comes, and that's about the length of one of the devices that we experiment with at Onami. On the next slide is a close-up of these channels. You see this bigger holes, that's where the oil comes up and starts flowing down the channel, and two adjacent holes left to right, they bring alcohol into a close contact, and they flow in parallel through the channel. The channel is about 200 microns wide and 100 microns deep, so it's about the size of your hair. That's how small they are. On the next slide is a device that we have and that we use in everyday's experiments. We suspect that this would be roughly the way we would put these devices for commercial use, and they could come in all kinds of sizes depending on how many channels we put per square inch and how many plates we use in these devices. On the next slide, this is one of the sketches of the experimental results that we obtain. On down at the bottom you have a time in seconds, and on the other side we have biodiesel conversion in percentages. The green line shows what one could find as the best result in the literature about the biodiesel conversion, and the red line is what we can get in our lab. Obviously, we can do it much faster, and therefore that's what enables us to make a smaller devices for the same capacity. In the next slide, I'll try to argue why we should go into this this business beyond the technical capabilities of these devices that could be used for all kinds of applications. So the next one is the first one is that this process technology is very flexible. We can build devices that can be used in biorefineries that are typically 50 million gallons of biodiesel a year, all the way to small mobile units that could be good for individual users, like a group of farmers or a farmer with a larger chunk of land where these crops that bring oil would be appropriate to use. On the next item is about the small markets in remote areas where people can grow energy, basically. This technology will enable them to produce energy right there where the stuff is grown. These people would typically not have a chance even to get on the radar screen of a big biorefinery because they cannot produce as much. You know, biorefinery needs train loads of oil every day. somebody who has 200 acres, 2,000 acres of the crop wouldn't mean anything for biorefinery. With this technology, they can get into that market. They can produce energy. Modest capacity units could be, you know, this is not a unique situation in Oregon or in United States. We can easily imagine that somebody may have interest of using these devices elsewhere in the world, in countries that are emerging and that have do not have infrastructure, large energy infrastructure, where distributed production of energy will be very useful. On the next slide, we continue with this discussion. One very important thing is that big biorefineries typically use two types of oil. It's either soybean oil or canola oil. How about other oils like a cottonseed oils, mustard seed oils, and there are a few other types of grains that can give us triglycerides, which is the oil that we use. This brings us to the next item that allows this technology to be integrated into a larger production systems. For example, if somebody will have a cottonseed oils that are used as a feed, as a cattle feed, oil that comes out of these seeds is a byproduct. These people would love to have an opportunity to convert that oil, which is a byproduct in their own industry, into energy. So we are talking about the integrability of this technology into other systems. The next item... Now,
excuse me. So what you're saying is when they make the cattle feed, they want to take the oil out of the cotton seed or whatever first before it becomes the cattle food.
The cattle food, that's correct.
I just wanted to be clear. That's what
That's what I'm almost certain, because we had several inquiries from Louisiana and Texas about this technology, and people on the phone were explaining this to me with regard to cotton seed.
So that's exciting. Right now, the oil isn't used... or maybe it's being used for something, but they have it as a byproduct of making the cattle feed right now.
Yeah,
they would use that byproduct.
And this is not a unique situation, because in meat production there is a lot of fat that is an excess fat in a meat production that is also a raw material for biodiesel. So it's same scheme. There are no enough fat around this country to run a big biorefinery, but there will be plenty of places where, with the smaller units, we can integrate them with meat slaughtering house or meat packaging houses.
Fascinating.
On the next slide, we continue with this argument, and investigate what kind of businesses one can develop using this technology. And the one that came to our mind, and people who are contacting us, is related to equipment production. If this would take off, there will be definitely companies that would love to have a chance to produce this equipment, as well as services that go with this, like a quality control of the fuel and some usage of glycerol that comes out from that that product. It could be put into a business venture that would mean quite a bit for the price of biodiesel. On the next item is... one thing that was given to me by a person who understands these issues a little bit more: for every carbon that we have in biodiesel and burn it as a fuel, that carbon was previous year in the air. So it is recycled, and therefore no new carbon is put, or carbon dioxide was put in the air. However, that carbon which was in the oil was followed by two other carbon atoms that were built into the roots and stems and leaves of the plant that ends up in the soil. Therefore, it is a way of sequestering carbon while we are using solar energy, basically, in this case.
Hmm.
Very few people pay attention to that. It's a shorter cycle. It's not a 5 million year cycle, but it is a way of reducing the carbon dioxide in the air. On the next slide is my list of entities that could benefit from production of biodiesel. And it is very strange that I had to start with the large petroleum, classical petroleum companies, Exxons and Mobiles of this country, because they are getting into this business. They're seeing that many states and definitely many countries around this planet are mandating today use of biodiesel as a blend in with the commercial classical biodiesel, and they want to be on that market. They want to be owner of these processes, and they're probably the largest players that can come up. Also, larger biorefineries, they may have interest in this technology because there is no reason why they would ignore something that's smaller for physically smaller and smaller capital investment for their bioreactors that make biodiesel. Small regional transportation fuel producers, regional agriculture cooperatives, somehow intuitively we assume that two or three farmers will get together and put together a plant that will produce enough biodiesels for their energy needs on the field and maybe have some leftovers to serve communities around. I already mentioned producers that are integrated with other industries like meat industry, cattle food industry, and maybe others. Equipment producers, and finally government should have an interest in this. For every dollar that we spend on for biodiesel production, it will be spent in the state of Oregon, and it would have, as I'm informed, 2.7 chances a year to turn around, and government would have a chance to tax it for every transaction. Not to speak that that would create jobs and possibly other benefits that come from that. So I think the government should have an interest in that too. On the next slide, I'm listing what are the next steps as we see them, especially as connected to human resources and Onami resources. We are in need to build a demonstration unit of a nominal size. We have these small units that we can carry around, show them in the lab, and so on, but we need a unit that would produce 10,000 gallons, 100,000 gallons a year, and it should be tangible. People should be able to come, touch it, and see it. It's much better than me talking to others right now. We also have a need to develop manufacturing technology that would produce necessary pieces. As you've seen, these are just the plastic sheets that really make up these units. For a large, in its large scale and inexpensive production of these units. We also are on the route of educating the new generation of PhDs. A lot of people from Oregon, from farmers' background coming to us, and they're interested in participating in this. And these will be the people who would take this knowledge and spread it around and carry that around. And finally, we see launching small businesses that would supplement this whole process as we go ahead. And I think that concludes my, on the next slide, is just thank you for listening to me and giving us your support in the past, especially with the NAMI Center and College of Engineering.
Thank you very much. I want to go back three pages in your handout. Maybe that's six, seven, eight slides, I don't know. But you have this chart that shows the graph of traditional biodiesel production and new micro reactor production. On that slide, what you're saying is that The percentage of conversion never gets past about 65-70% on traditional. Can you explain that a little more? I mean, so there's more waste in the traditional one than in...
No, it isn't. You just have to wait a little bit longer. You know, that line is still going up, so I suppose somewhere beyond that wall it would probably come to that level.
Oh, so it still produce much.
Yes.
It would just take a week to get there.
Not a week. It takes several hours or a whole day to get it. This is a reversible reaction, and you cannot reach 100% conversion.
Right.
The good results are 95% conversion, and everybody gets these 95, except that we do it in, 100th of their time or faster.
Yeah, you do it very fast because of the...
proximity,
the microtechnology involved.
Yeah, the proximity of the reactants in these small entities.
Okay, what's exciting to me about this is that it sounds so good that as soon as you get to a prototype, it's probably going to get bought up or something by some big company or something that has lots of money that wants to kind of capture this market. How do you keep that from happening, or do you want that to happen?
Frankly, this is a little bit out of my league right now, and I'm glad you asked these questions. My telephone is maxed out. No more messages. My email is in trouble for days already since this press release came out, and I've got calls from Portland, from Clackamas, from Warm Springs, from Bend, as well as from South Africa and Australia about this, and I'll be glad to give you all of these emails as soon as I get them sorted out. And Dean Adams will probably tell you that we are organizing ourselves not only for this project but others as well to accept these communications and convert them to the best that we can know. I must say we are probably close making a deal with a company in Clackamas here that is very interested in one aspect of this.
How long will it take to create or build the nominal unit that you mentioned in here?
We produced a document for one group of venture capitalists who wanted to put the money in that, and it would take about 12 to 18 months, including manufacturing process. That is setting up all of the operation for large-scale manufacturing, which will be probably injection molding or stamping or embossing into a plastic sheets and welding these sheets together into a block. So I think we are at the stage when somebody does research, you can bring tons of money and you may not get results faster than whatever. But we are in the stage where more money would buy extra time, would buy us a time. We could walk faster if we have more investments into this.
I just want to add to Goran's response to your question. We do have a concern that is definitely interested in investment and are in the process of arranging a meeting that will take place probably in the next few weeks to get to what Goran described as sort of the working prototype. And as you heard, there are lots of people out there that may be customers as opposed to actual investors or developers of this technology. So that's part of what we'll be sorting out is which of these opportunities are future market opportunities for a new company that would likely be housed in Oregon making these micro bioreactors for biodiesel that are sold not only in Oregon but also worldwide.
Fascinating stuff. Senator Bay.
Yeah, just a couple quick questions. Two sessions ago, we passed a law that would allow but ask that universities who came up with new technology that when they formed relationships with companies would retain some copyrights on those and would get some revenue streams off those. OHSU has done a very good job of doing that. Mm-hmm. I would assume that Oregon State University has looked at this type of technology and is making relationships that will work
not just by getting the technology up, but we'll be in a situation where you'll have some revenue coming back for the work that's been done.
Right. I'll
make that assumption. Second, the real question, you can answer that also, but the second question is, are there any cost estimates on what these reactors will cost, like per gallon produced? Is it too soon to be able to do that, or can you give us some rough ideas what you think that might cost?
I'm glad you asked that question. As I mentioned, the production of biodiesel is a low temperature operation. Alcohol evaporates at 60 degrees Celsius, so plastic polymer materials are building materials. We actually got in trouble because of this. One of these reactors could cost anywhere between $2,000 and $10,000 for a capacity of between 100,000 gallons to 1 million gallons. And people who are looking for a business didn't like that exactly. They wanted this to be a little bit more expensive so they can earn money on selling these units. Although these units would be these units will be disposable in a sense that once something goes wrong with them, I don't think we will be ever opening them up to clean them up or anything. We will just replace them.
I guess that kind of goes with my question. How do you filter the oil going in so it doesn't clog them up immediately?
That's a good question. With microtechnology and microchannels, that's a classical problem. These channels can tolerate particles up to 20 microns, which is one-fifth of your hair. Everything larger than that would clog them. Very simple filters that come up front, the unit would take care of that.
Simple filters that are very, very, very small. Go ahead.
Let me ask the question a different way. Right now, we can buy biodiesel, and I can buy it in our local community where I live, and it's about 3 1/4 a gallon, which looked really expensive a few months ago. It doesn't now. But the question is, would this lower the cost of that, or is this a technology that allows you to produce more faster but not necessarily lower the cost of that production?
Well, it is related somewhat to the capital cost of the equipment that one would put into such a unit. And I don't have a straight answer to your question. We've been talking about the price, and especially with people who are visiting us at this moment, we are talking about this, and they're interested in capital cost, and they figure out the rest of the story. I better keep my comments to this level.
Well, it may be premature for you to say anything. I don't understand. Yeah. You may not know the cost yet.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this anticipate you're going to replace diesel itself, or is this where you'll be mixing? Is that the idea? Or can you just do a B100 or however you figure those out?
That is something that is already happening around the world. Europe has a mandate this year that all biodiesel has to be 5%, all the diesel fuel has to be 5% biodiesel. By 2012, it will be 20% biodiesel. Those are huge amounts of diesel. And I understand some states in U.S. have similar arrangements. Nothing in energy industry will happen abruptly. There will be transitioning from one form into the energy. I personally see the future of in energy as much more diverse than it is today. And biodiesel and all biofuels, including ethanol, will have their place. And will have their exclusive place. For example, I think it would be very wise to take all our waterways and lakes and ocean engines and use biodiesel for them exclusively. If one spills the biodiesel on the ground, you don't have to do anything with it. It disappears in a few days. Bacteria just eat it. It's not toxic at all. There is no need for intervention.
And that would be 100% biodiesel.
100% biodiesel, not the blend, right. So On our pristine lakes, it would make sense to have engines that would use exclusively 100% biodiesel.
Okay. Senator, a couple more. Just, is there any application to, like, woody biomass or anything like that? Is that in part of your plans?
That is something that very often comes to us lately. Yeah, there is, with microtechnology, we have plans to perform something called specifically Fischer-Tropsch synthesis. That's technology invented by Germans before the World War II, where gases from pyrolysis of the biomass are taken into a process where basically everything else is produced. It's a carbon monoxide and hydrogen that could be generated from steam reforming, pyrolysis, gasification of biomass. Once they become gaseous, in the gaseous or liquid form, this technology can take them away to anything, to plastics, to fuels, to. But that is a more complicated proposition and definitely needs more research.
Just one. Coming earlier on your testimony, you talked about east of the Cascades, that there was a lot of the oil seeds and things of that nature. I think that might be a misassumption, because I farm out east of the Cascades, and the oil seeds are very difficult to grow in our part of the country. We don't get the rain that you do down here. I think it's a great concept. It will probably help the Canadian farmer who can sell his stuff at 7 cents a pound and make a living off it. But I don't see that the Oregon farmer, one, because he has too many choices from other crops. We can grow over 250 different crops in this state. And if for a farmer to grow oil seeds or something, you're going to have to get at least 15 cents a pound. And that's about twice the going market right now. So, I mean, I like the concept of it, but if it's going to... It's not going to help me as a farmer, probably, if I have to compete with Canada. If I have the choice, I'm probably going to raise something else. And one of the questions I asked on that woody biomass is that I see the Oregon farmer getting a benefit out of this if he can use the crop residue in addition to the crop. And it's kind of an energy, you know, going along with the woody biomass, everything together. So. If I could sell my residue, my straw or whatever it is that comes out of the end of a combine for $20 a ton, that makes a lot more difference to me. So I just so you don't have a misconception that you're going to be the savior of all the farms out there in eastern Oregon, I doubt that that's going to happen.
Well, 2 years ago, I didn't know anything about crops, and I probably am very dangerous right now because I learned a little. But the fact is that 2 days ago, I got a call from Pendleton, from a group of farmers there who are growing canola.
How many? That's my question. I have grown canola in the past, but I'm not going to grow it again.
It was he mentioned it was a rotational crop. It wasn't their prime focus, and they want to know if they could do something. I asked them for a capacity and so on, and certainly we could use one of these devices there to help them out. I don't know why people from Warm Springs called me. I don't know how much they have over there, or if they do anything. People from Bend also did have some interest. So, as I said, this is not something that we will go out and solve the energy crisis of the state. This is a very distributed thing. This is thing that's located on a small environment. So if somebody has an interest and has 200 acres, 2,000 acres, and if they have an interest to do it, they can do it. Before that, they couldn't.
Yeah,
I think that's where the point is. It's not, you know, engaging everything beyond the Cascade to grow our seeds. I don't think. Well, I'll.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so Mr. Chair, I would agree, and I really like the concept and the idea, and I think a small farmer, you know, if I could replace my fuel costs with something, I think that's really great. But
I may not want to grow a lot of that because it's very difficult to grow in our part of the country.
Yeah. Maybe easier to grow other places, but I mean, and it's not a solution for everything, as you said, yeah. But sure is an exciting...
I think it's a great concept.
Exciting technological step forward.
Absolutely.
Really is.
Well, I guess to the point you heard earlier, there's also a meat processor that's in Clackamas and having conversations with Garon as well.
And the meat processor?
Well, the idea there is to use the unused fat from that process as a feedstock.
I'll be game. Amazing stuff.
Yeah, it's good.
Thank you so much for sharing that with
yeah,
us.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
This all fits the bigger puzzle that we're trying to put together later on. We're at the last item on our agenda this afternoon, which is a big one. I had asked if the governor's office would come and talk point by point about the pertinent components of the 2005 package, the biofuels package that was introduced in the last legislative session. And so Dave Vanhoff is here. And as you're listening, I know there's only a few of you here, but if you're listening out there and you want to say, Dave, you missed one, I'm going to allow that. Is that okay?
Yeah.
My goal here is for us to be able to take some notes and to really pretty much understand point by point what the pertinent components of that package and also what you've been working on in the governor's office. And we're not doing this in the vacuum. We know that the House Ag Committee is studying this whole thing too. So what are we all doing, whether it's the House Committee, the Governor's Office, or this Senate Committee? What are the pertinent parts that all of us are looking at? Am I making sense here, or did I make sense? Are you okay? Okay.
Thanks, Senator Chair Shields, for inviting me to come in today. For the record, Dave Antoff from the Governor's Office Sustainability Policy Advisor, and Chair Shields, committee members. Like Senator Shields said, there's some folks in the room that were intimately involved in the bill efforts in 2005, and they can come up after me or chime in if there's anything I'm leaving out. I was asked to just kind of try and walk through pretty objectively what were the provisions in the various manifestations of the bills that went through the 05 session. And that's all I've really come prepared to do. I'm happy to try and expand beyond that as well if there's questions. I sent to Judith a document. Was that distributed?
Yes.
Okay. So I was going to try and just walk through that, so it's it'd be helpful if folks have it as well. And before getting into the specifics of the prior bills, I just want to give a little bit of a real brief background from the governor's perspective about the biofuels issue and his involvement. He did not introduce a bill in the 05 session, but what he did was he put together the Renewable Energy Action Plan that to some extent became part of the driver for portions of the bill. And the Renewable Energy Action Plan, which was put together by a diverse group of stakeholders and looked at various energy and inputs from wind energy to geothermal to fuels, that plan had recommended a goal for the state of increasing biodiesel and ethanol use within the state, both within state fleets, state government, and also statewide. And the numbers that were recommended in that Renewable Energy Action Plan became part of the basis for the proposals for fuel standards for the state in the bills that came out of that. So turning to the document that you've got, the original... There was originally a package of bills introduced in the House by a fairly large group of legislators, but including Representative Dingfelder and Krupp, who kind of had been participating in the interim prior to 05, to craft some bipartisan or concepts for bills. And so the list that you have there from House Bill 3030 to House Bill 3035 were introduced on the House side. And in addition, the governor, through the Department of Energy, introduced Senate Bill 736 on the Senate side. We can dispense with Senate Bill 736 pretty quickly. That one was ultimately passed by both houses and signed into law by the governor. And that was the siting bill, essentially, that made it easier for biodiesel facilities to site. It exempted them from the SEC process the same way that ethanol facilities previously by prior legislature had been exempted. So for House Bills 3030 through 3035, quickly, I was just going to walk through what they provided in very general terms. I've got the full text of the measures here if anybody wants to get copies of that or read through it. But House Bill 3030 expanded the property tax exemption for ethanol production facilities to include biodiesel production facilities and oilseed crushing facilities, and it made it optional for local taxing districts whether or not they wanted to extend that new exemption. House Bill 3031 allowed farm equipment used for biofuels crop production to qualify for the pollution control tax credit. House Bill 3032 provided incentives to utilize Oregon crops for biofuels production through tax credits. House Bill 3033 required a minimum blend of renewable fuel and gasoline and diesel sold in the state, and that's kind of oftentimes called a fuel standard or a fuel mandate. House Bill 3034, and the numbers that were set out in that House Bill 3033 were consistent with the Renewable Energy Action Plan again. House Bill 3034 required state government to use biodiesel to account for a certain percentage of its overall use. And it also allowed refunds on fuel use tax for those folks that were using light-duty vehicles and farm equipment with 100% biodiesel to fuel them. House Bill 3035 created a clean school bus grant fund. The intent was to create a fund for retrofitting school bus engines or to utilize biodiesel in school buses. And the funding proposed in that bill came from a new surcharge on Department of Agriculture's license fees for fuel metering devices. And then we've already covered Senate Bill 736. So those were introduced in the House. They were referred to the House Environment Committee, and that committee then consolidated the biofuels package into one bill. And that became House Bill 3481. And some of the things that it did are set out here in the... I think all the things that it did are set out in the bullets here, but and I'll walk through them. The new consolidated House Bill 3481 kept a property tax exemption for biofuels and added an exemption for verified fuel additive production facilities. So roughly, it kept House Bill 3030 with some additions. It kept provision allowing biofuels and biomass plants, as well as equipment used to produce biofuels or grow crops from biofuels to qualify for the pollution control tax credit, so essentially keeping House Bill 3031. It kept a provision creating new tax credits to the agricultural producers of biofuel raw materials, the feedstock, so keeping House Bill 3032. It deleted the renewable fuel standard provisions from House Bill 3033. It deleted the requirement that state government use a certain amount of biofuels and replaced that with an encouragement for or directing state agencies to use biofuels to the maximum extent economically possible. So with a tweak, it kept the House Bill 3034. It kept the provision for the refund of the use fuel tax on 100% biodiesel purchased for certain vehicles, so keeping House Bill 3034 had kind of the two provisions, so I separated those two there. It kept the provision creating a clean school bus grant fund, but eliminated the funding source, so kept portions of House Bill 3035, and added an extension of the sunset on the pollution control tax credit program. It added a tax credit for research and development of equipment that would produce biofuels and related things. And it added a provision banning MTBE and other gasoline additives. It added a provision extending the eligibility for expedited facility siting, which this is essentially Senate Bill 736. It was run both as a separate Senate bill and then was added into this bill. And it added what was kind of characterized as Section 40 that provided that the ETC, when it engaged in rulemaking, needed to ensure that the rules permitted and encouraged the sale or lease of new motor vehicles and new agricultural vehicles and equipment that use biodiesel. So that's the consolidated House bill that was then passed over to the Senate. Again, if I've left something out, hopefully someone will chime in after this. The Senate then made some modifications to House Bill 3481. Specifically, they kept the property tax exemption. I should say before the Senate bill was modified, it went to vote on the Senate floor, and the House bill as it came over, and I think the vote there was the 16-14. It was a very close vote, but it was not passed as sent over from the House, went through modifications in the Senate committee, where they kept the property tax exemption for biofuels. They kept the extension, and this is in reference to the consolidated House Bill 3481, what the Senate did. They kept the extension of the pollution control tax credit to include the biofuels and biomass plants. They kept the provision of tax credits for producers of biofuel raw materials. They kept the Clean School Bus Grant Fund with no seed funding. They kept the ban on MTBE. They kept the extension of eligibility for expediting facilities against Senate Bill 736 provision. They kept the provision directing state government to use alternative fuel to the maximum extent economically feasible. They kept the reduction in the fuel tax on biodiesel. They reinstated the renewable fuel standard, but added a limitation that it's only triggered if certain number of gallons of the fuels were produced in Oregon. I'm pretty sure that was added. They eliminated the extension of the sunset on the entire pollution control tax credit program. They eliminated the Section 40. They eliminated tax credit for research and development, I believe, again. And they added several other additional policies from other bills around renewable energy, which included a 1% solar for construction of new government buildings, providing lottery bonds for renewable energy R&D, allowed construction of renewable energy facilities on state lands, and extended the sunset date on the sustainability board. So that's what came out of the Senate and passed, and then went into conference committee. And the kind of the gist of putting all this on paper was, you can see there's a long list of agreed upon provisions that came out passed both the House and the Senate. So in the conference committee, the portions that passed both houses, I set out here. I'm not going to go through the list again, but it's in a fairly extensive list. And then there was only a few provisions that were not agreed to in the conference committee. One was around inclusion of a renewable fuel standard. One was around extension of a sunset on the entire pollution control tax credit program. One was around inclusion of the Section 40 language. One was around inclusion of tax credit for research and development. And one was around the inclusion of the additional renewable energy policies, although I'd note that those last two, at least in my opinion, were not really factors in the conference committee discussions. I think that both sides, both the House and Senate, would have agreed to ultimately inclusion of those last two provisions, but there never was an agreement reached in the conference committee. So that, in a very quick nutshell, I think, sets out kind of the procedural history for the biofuels provisions and what happened with them, and then kind of what the barriers were in the end to getting an agreement between the two houses in the conference committee.
Got a headache yet?
It's not as interesting as the fire slideshow presentation, I believe.
It'll never compete with a microreactor.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Senator Bates, do you have a question or comment?
I would follow after you. If you have questions, I'd follow after you may ask the questions that I want answered also.
Well,
I did not follow this during session very tightly because I was tied up on other issues.
Right.
And I saw this as one of sort of a sad failure at the end of session where I thought both sides were close to agreement and then it kind of fell apart and we never had a chance to put it back together again. So much was agreed to. I mean, some small parts that weren't agreed to. I just wanted to hear some fleshing out, if we could, about the parts that were not agreed to. I have some questions about that, and I imagine that's probably what we're going through.
Yeah,
I'll probably, essentially,
mine is the same question. It's just kind of where have we gone since this, at the governor's office level or in some meetings? I mean, I realize if you've got stuff that you're in negotiation about, you can't talk about it, don't talk about it at this point. But I do hear that there's been some meeting around and trying to arrive at some consensus. I don't know if you're getting there. It's not a conference committee, but I'm sure you're basically talking about some of the portions that were not agreed to in that conference committee as the sticking points.
Yeah.
So where are we now?
Senator Chair Shields, the governor, where he's at in the big picture is he's elevated this issue to one of his key priorities going forward. It was pulled out in the State of the State as a part of his energy independence package, and he is committed to passage of biofuels legislation in 07. So from the big picture, that's where he's at. He wants real, meaningful biofuels legislation that's going to drive the market in the state of Oregon.
Okay, but what are the component parts of his?
Getting to the component parts, we have not developed a list saying this is what the governor's office will support and this is what we won't support. We're trying to find out what the options are, where between the Senate process and the House process, where the politics are and where people think there could be consensus around. There's procedurally at the governor has a two work groups, essentially a renewable energy work group that has been formed with legislative participation, and one of their tasks is to try and develop consensus-based legislative principles for a biofuels package. So where specific provisions that are going to go into a bill that is going to get through both houses and signed by the governor into law are going to come from, I can't tell you, and I can't tell you what the specific provisions are going to be. We do know from last session that the biggest sticking points were around the Section 40 piece, and I fleshed that out. There was concerns from the governor's office and from some state agencies and stakeholders that provision essentially from the governor's office perspective was tied into the tailpipe emission issues. And there was concerns that may, the language in there, it was not very clear exactly what it did, but there was concern that it could provide some claims that the EQC was not authorized to move forward on tailpipe emission standards. So that was kind of the tie-in with Section 40 and a big stumbling point from the governor's office perspective. On the pollution control tax credit program, there was, again, from the governor's office and I think from some of the from the senator's perspectives, an unwillingness to fully extend the pollution control tax credit program. And then on the fuel standard piece,
sure.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Well, I'm not sure I heard this correctly. Governor had trouble with the extension of the entire PCTC?
Correct.
And you thought the Senate did too?
There was members of the Senate that I don't know if the Senate ever as a body that had a position on it.
I know there's many members of both parties who actually didn't have a problem with that, and some that did. So I don't know.
That's right.
I don't know what the vote count was.
Right, and I don't. I mean, again, there was a 16-14 vote.
But you and I thought it was okay. Is
no, the only vote that happened there was 2-1 in a conference meeting.
Okay.
Well, I mean, there was also Chair Shields' vote in the Senate on the bill that was passed over from the House, which included a full extension of the pollution control tax credit. And that, my recollection was, it was a 16-14 vote against passage of that bill.
Came to the floor?
I needed 18.
Correct.
Is that the right numbers?
Did it need 18?
It need 18.
I don't think it ever came before.
I can't remember.
I may be wrong.
I could be mistaken. Does anyone have a recollection?
I do.
Come on up and sit down, John.
I have searing recollections. Reoccurring at night.
Searing? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Ledger, AOI. The pollution control tax credit piece was part of the big bill. It came out of the House. And it passed very handily. I think there might have been only 12 votes against it or something out of the House. But a lot of people, you know, in fairness, I have to say, a lot of people voted for that bill. And there may have been, there were lots of pieces in it they liked or didn't like, but they wanted to move it along.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I would love to be able to say that everything in it, everybody loved but 12 or 18 or whatever the no vote was. And maybe that was. But I think there was also a feeling like we need to move it along. But nonetheless, it came out pretty handily. And the PCTC piece was... in the bill was substantially expanded. I mean, not just in length of time, but in breadth. And I think that was one of the things that, you know, we were talking, it was like 2 a.m. It was one of the things, if there had been more time, maybe we would have gotten there. But the pollution control tax credit thing is exceedingly complicated because you're dealing with times, percentages, breadth, and there are all these pieces that, you know, that I think probably could have been, I think, you know, I'm thinking worked out, but it just would have taken time.
And 2 o'clock in the morning wasn't.
It wasn't coming together, and.
There's no vote on the bill in the Senate side?
On the set, the bill, not on the pollution control, the bill that came, well, interestingly enough, there was, I believe, a minority report that had the pollution control piece in. Was a minority report, I think, and it failed. And then the regular bill came out that did not have the pollution control tax credit piece in, and that passed over to the House where there was non-concurrence.
Yes.
So you had really two quite different bills, and there were things that were tacked on to both of them. I wouldn't use the word whimsically, but I mean it was complicated. You had the sustainability board, you know, they got put on some, did get put on the other, but. So it was a long and it was a complicated thing. I think it just would have taken more time. I know we were very concerned about pollution control tax credits, and we kind of asked for a lot in there. We would have settled for less, but there was less time, and it was one of those things that happened late. And frankly, I think it's one of those things that had to happen late, because if we had been discussing it earlier, it just would have been discussed up to the last instant anyway. But I know I have to say we were talking at 2 a.m. and it was going back and forth, and everyone was getting really cranky. Yeah.
I wonder why.
That was my record.
John, question. I mean, and this kind of, to me, gets to the crux of the issue. The tax credit wasn't added until it got to the House. It wasn't a part of these bills that were originally introduced by Dingfelder and Crump.
That, Mr. Chairman, no, that's not true. The original bills by Dingfelder and Crump, which was a set of bills, did add biodiesel facilities to pollution control tax credit program. The problem with that is to get your credit, you can't even apply for the credit until after you've already hired everybody, built, and it's up and running and functional, then you apply for the credit. And because the program was expiring, it was a dead issue. You couldn't get the thing built fast enough to take use of the credit. So you had to extend the pollution control tax piece out. Otherwise, it was a corpse of an issue. Because by the time you got the thing built and applied for the credit, the program would have died. So I think that was a drafting error. I don't know, but so it was in the original set.
So it was in 3031. How do you respond to that, Dave? John just was saying. I mean,
my understanding of the original bill was, yes, in the way I characterized it, the pollution control tax credit, it would have extended the breadth of that program to include the biofuels crop stuff. And so everybody agreed to that. What the disagreement was, and the at least some of the drafters of the 3031 bill didn't anticipate that that meant that you'd be extending the sunset on the entire program.
Wasn't there a timeline that the pollution control tax credit was going to be sunsetted?
It's sunsetting now.
Yeah.
But the trick is you have to. It's not like you get the credit and then you build. You can only get the credit after you've finished all the building and the thing is up and running. Okay. And so unless you have the thing extended, nobody could use it.
I guess I'm asking where the mistake was made, if it was a mistake. If you have a pollution control tax credit that is sunsetting, why would these people who worked on Senate Bill 3031 have farm equipment used for biofuels crop production qualify for a pollution control tax credit? How can you be sunsetting something and add something to it at the same time? I mean, did they envision a continuation of a very narrow pollution control tax credit? What, you know, legislative intent is always talked about around here when we try to figure out what's going on.
Mr. Chair, I'll speculate. And that the pollution control tax credit is not well understood. And people think it's a tax credit you can apply for by hand. I think it was just a misunderstanding. I think somebody said, hey, you know, let's include it in the pollution control tax credit program. It got in. When you read the pollution control tax credit statute and try to figure out when it expires, I mean, it's very, very difficult. And I think it was just, I think it was honestly just an oversight. I don't think it was malicious. I don't think it was done to do anything bad. I think it was just they stuck it in and nobody looked to see when the thing expired. And it's very difficult to read. I could understand how it could happen.
Yeah. I agree. I think the program expires over phases, and so there may have been some sense that if you passed a provision extending it to biofuels, and it may make them subject to the credit for a certain period, 2 years, 3 years, I don't know what they were thinking, but that you would get credit for a period of time before it sunsetted. They probably, you know, I wasn't part of the negotiations. I don't know what was originally thought in terms of the bill, but I wouldn't be surprised if they were thinking, well, you know, there may be portions of the tax credit that could be extended beyond the sunset, like this portion, without a meeting of the minds about the full breadth of the entire program being extended, or you know, what kind of, if it was extended, what time frame.
But there was no extension, and it would be physically impossible to get it done in time to get the credit.
On what night was it this week? Tuesday night or Wednesday night this week, I got to go see the Blazers play the Lakers with my son. I took him to the game, and it was fun that the Blazers finally have a big guy in the middle that can block the movement. This pollution control tax credit has become kind of like the big guy in the middle that can block movement on a whole bunch of bills. Is that going to have to be the case the whole way through this struggle, do you think? Or is there some way that we can get that guy to go back to the bench and sit down?
Well, a couple of things, Mr. Chairman. One of all is I'm always hesitant to discuss lobbying strategy in open committee. The other is I really don't think it's a big guy blocking. I think it's a big guy that can do a whole heck of a lot of good if you let him. And because he is a big guy on the opposition team, I think sometimes there are people that would rather not see him in the game.
Mr. Chair, I'll throw my two bits in. This is start coming back as sort of a bad dream I threw away. My right frontal headache is coming back as I think about this more. I remember having discussions with some representatives on this as it went back over. And correct me if my memory is now failing me, but I think this is some of what was going on. There were those in the House who were opposed to pollution tax credits in any shape or form. Shouldn't be doing them. you should comply with the law. It's your job as an industry to do so. We don't believe in this stuff. There's others like myself who will be able to do other place. Improperly applied, you know, the public wants, and I want a better environment, but you have to pay for that. And the job of paying for that is not just the industry, but we have a responsibility as government to take part in that too. So I feel that some of this should be extended. Others don't follow that. Others also feel that it's not broad enough. We should be doing a lot more with personal tax credits, and we should be putting more money in the program altogether. So you have this sort of thing going on. And down the middle somewhere, I think if you've had time and could have gotten together, you would have probably come up with a program said, we are going to extend the pollution tax credits, not just for biofuels, but for other areas too that we think are appropriate, and a compromise could have been reached.
It would have been narrower.
It would have been probably narrower, but longer in some areas. When you're doing a situation where you're negotiating, you're going to put everything out there at first, and then you're going to accept something less in the end. And those who want nothing are going to have to say, well, we'll accept something too. I don't think you ever got to that process. And that's kind of the nightmare that I remember. We ran out of time. It was August. We left. So what I'm looking at now is, I'm hoping there's a work group forming to come up with some form of consensus before January. I'm hoping the governor is leading that charge.
Senator Bates, the governor, going back to that nightmare of NIDA-ERP process, the position he was taking at that point was he supported an extension of the pollution control tax credit to the extent it went applied to companies doing something above and beyond what they were required to do by law. Because there's different components of the existing credit. Some arguably apply for complying with law. Some arguably only apply if you are going above and beyond what you're required to do. He took the position that was where you could split the difference and say, let's continue a program around that incentive side of encouraging folks to go above what they are required to do by law. And that gets very complicated as John gets into it, what does it mean to comply with law and all that kind of stuff. But that was kind of where he was coming from. In terms of going forward in the state of the state, what he called for as part of his energy independence package was a targeted set of tax credits that are looking at today going forward in terms of energy independence and potentially other things, but what does the state need from a tax credit perspective from 2005 to 2030 or whatever we're looking at, and let's figure out a narrower focused set of credits, which he couched in terms of renewable energy and carbon emission reductions, but something tied to energy independence. That's going to be tax credits for the future as opposed to a continuation of, you know, a 30-year-old program, which was a very important program, but looking at it with a new fresh look. And yeah. So that's kind of where he's at going forward.
And I think there's possibilities. The part of the credit where you just did something and you got the credit is gone. That lapsed. The only way you can get the credit by not going above and beyond is if you're in a distressed area or an economic enterprise zone, pretty much. Other than that, you have to go do something. And the question becomes, going above and beyond what? And there are really two layers of rules. There's the federal minimums and there's state. And one of the reasons, of course, we have supported DEQ, as you know, strongly, is the state rules tend to be more strict than federal, and that's okay. A lot of states, it's illegal to do that. The legislature passed laws that says you can't be more strict than federal minimums. And we don't support that. Well, I don't think that's a good idea. And so when they say we're conforming with law, I mean, we think if all you're doing is conform with federal law only, you know, where there's a number that says 5 and you're only doing 5 and that's the federal number, I don't think there's a good reason for it unless you want to do an economic development side. But we're complying with state law, and we've backed strict state laws because one of the reasons is we got a little bit of relief through the pollution control tax credit. And so now, as reward for backing the more strict state laws, we hear, well, all you're doing is following the law, so you don't need the credit. So it's a tricky thing. I think there'll be more discussions on it. I will tell you, there are people that view opposition to pollution control tax credits as an extremely litmus test issue. I mean, just hardcore. Don't like them.
I have to say that a lot of those people, probably myself included, don't or haven't studied the complexity of the pollution control tax credit. They simplify it, and I've heard it simplified this way 1,000 times. Why are we paying people for complying with the law? You know, and that's all you hear.
And that's all you hear, and you don't hear that, well, you're complying with a law that's different here than it is in Minnesota or New Jersey or whatever, because they only have to follow federal laws here. We have to follow federal and stricter state, that's why. And the other thing is, and I've...
But we haven't heard.
Well, the other thing that I've told people, you know, frankly, and this is almost like the bottom line, companies compete against Pacific Rim, they compete against other companies, other branches of their own company around the country. And what they do is companies consolidate and they close facilities. And I always tell people, if a company's going to close a facility and put people out of work, I want them to put people out of work in Minnesota. Because they're going to do it somewhere. And I want them to put Minnesotans out of work. Or people in New York. Or people in Washington State.
Or Idaho?
Idaho's fine. I don't live there anymore. But that's almost the bottom issue. You're going to close... I want to put people out of work in other places. Add people here. I could talk for about an hour and a half on this, if you would like. But it would...
Senator Bennett.
Thank you. I would point out that Senator Brown's family lives in Minnesota.
Thank you very much for that piece of information.
The question, I've heard this before, and I appreciate going back over it, because it's been my position for a long time. This is from my first session when I really went into pollution control tax credits very carefully with Governor Kitzhaber as governor. We went through all this and extended it at that time. And I thought for good reasons. I still, those reasons are still there. The ones you've talked about, the ones I talked about. So it's a litmus test. I probably fail in certain areas because I believe pollution tax credits have a very important role to play and they should be maintained carefully.
Say carefully, you're saying within parameters?
Yeah, I think you've really got to get down and define these better and talk about what above and beyond means and where it really is effective. And I mean, one of my examples I always use is the recycling plant in Toledo, Oregon, which without pollution tax credit might close. The recycling cardboard there, it's huge paying jobs. The income tax we get from those jobs far outweighs the tax credits for it. Why do we want to jeopardize a plant like that by eliminating their pollution tax credit? I think they still qualify because of enterprise zone stuff. But I mean that kind of thing. Just a blanket statement that they're bad is not right. And we also don't want to be in a situation where they're being used inappropriately, but that has to be looked at. The point I was trying to get to here again is there a group working on this? If we wait till January, will this be a food fight again? And, to resolve these kind of very difficult issues that are this technical, it would be good to have a consensus group if possible bringing something forward.
I can say there are limited discussions going on. They haven't been in detail, but I think, and I don't mean to speak for the governor's office, but I think they're open to talking, and always. I mean, I've never had the governor's office not being willing to discuss anything. And so there are discussions going on. I think there will be always people that just, they want them to die. I mean, they've put a lot of effort into this. And then the last piece is, frankly, when you get to the session, it becomes an issue of lobbying strategy. And you're not going to see it come up early in the session because it'll draw too much fire. And stuff that comes up early a lot of times dies just because there's not much else for the press to write about or anything. And so that will all play out, but I think there will be things done and we'll be talking to all of you. But there are discussions going on, limited.
And Senator Bates, I'd add, the governor's office internally is looking at the tax credit issue and trying to come up with a consensus viewpoint within the governor's office, and then we're certainly wanting to extend that out and try and get in negotiations with others. But I think where the governor is at, he would prefer to see this issue, because it is a very complicated and a very politically sensitive issue dealt with on its own merits and not be dealt with as part of a biofuels package of bills next session. I mean, we're trying to figure out a way to get a consensus set of bills around biofuels that we can hopefully all say, this is a good set of bills, let's get it done, and then deal with the tax credit issues on some merits separately. Now, if the tax credits are going to be tied, limited to renewable energy production, development, manufacturing, that kind of stuff, maybe there's a reason to include that within the biofuels package. But generally, a general discussion of tax credits, whether it's pollution control tax credits or a new form of tax credits that meets business and environmental goals or whatever it is, we're very interested in having that discussion.
Senator Bates, you talked about being in Governor Kitzhaber's office when you were wrestling with some of this stuff and extending some, but it was that same Governor Kitzhaber, I think, that put us on the path toward the sunsetting of a lot of the pollution control tax credit stuff. So some of us that saw 2007 as kind of a sunset remember that that was part of it. And so I think we have to be more specific and have to learn the specifics of what's involved for the beginning.
And that discussion in his office was, at that time, around the same issue. Do we end them completely right now? If we don't, why not? And that's why they went for the extension on a limited basis for above and beyond. And the definition came up, what's above and beyond, what are the exemptions, same argument, same story. But the net result of that, of those meetings were, yeah, they're worth keeping under the limited thing, but we're going to sunset them so we can have that discussion again. We're having a discussion again.
From a lobbying strategy, Jim, is to keep it alive until we get a new governor.
That's a lobbying strategy. So what you're saying is you'd like to see it separated from the biofuels package, and what you're saying is a lobbying strategy, you don't want it separate, don't you?
Right. No, I'm sure I didn't say that.
You didn't say that. You talked about a new governor instead. Same message.
I will say we work very closely with DEQ a lot. The governor's office has always been open to us. I mean, always. And we're willing to talk to about anybody, anytime.
Okay. Do you want to get off the subject and let me ask another one?
Yes.
Or do you want to buy this? No. I think we beat this horse enough for today. We'll return and beat it for another day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have some questions and issues about what I would call a bubble effect of this thing. This is just some of the email. I take a farm magazine and pick up all these things, and it's going from Washington. State of Washington just passed a biodiesel law. They're going to encourage milling of plants out in southeast Washington, which is right across the river from where most of the stuff is probably could potentially be grown in Oregon, if it is grown. North Carolina, Kansas, Iowa. Are we going to get to the point where you're going to get overloaded in this thing and there will be a huge expansion by everybody, and then a bunch of people will go broke, and then there will be a consolidation, and the industry will go forward. And so how much does the state of Oregon want to invest in credits and things of this nature to maybe create a marketplace that is artificial and can only be handled by subsidies?
Churchill's, Senator Nelson, the fundamental issue is how much of the economic development strategy is this long-term, and what's the right way to create whatever that economic development opportunity is. And we can look at other states that have done biofuels. Really, Minnesota's the only one that's kind of been doing it for a while, and they've got an impressive track record, but they've got a unique set of circumstances in terms of ethanol production, corn, what's driving the markets there. But, I mean, in that instance, they're estimating that the economic impact of the state's ethanol program has been a creation of 2,562 jobs and $587 million industry. So the upside could be very up, whether we have the right pieces to make that kind of a market penetration or not. You know, that's what has to go into the crafting of the policy. I think the reality is that biofuels is here to stay, and it's only going to grow. I don't think it's a boom and then bust market. From federal policy to state policies to international pressures and to what we're seeing in terms of technology development, this is only going to be an expanding industry. So the question is going to be what states are going to get the best benefit from this expansion, who are going to be positioned to get the manufacturing, the technology, potentially the agricultural conversion. I know that you've got some questions about how much agricultural conversion can occur in Oregon, but that's something that we need to really look at tailoring any kind of policy around as one option is to make sure that it's creating economic opportunities in the agricultural sector. I think excuse me.
I wanted to make a comment.
Yeah.
And I say it to the gentleman to my left. Patty Smith and I went to the Ag Chairs Conference in Arizona. And there were, I think they said, 34 states across the country that have biofuels legislative packages in this legislative session. And that wouldn't include us guys that are on the oddballs, that are in the odd years instead of the even years. So it does bring back that question, will so many people be doing so much all at once that it does go bust? You know, and then it'll have to be a consolidation.
A normal market, I think, response would be to have a proliferation of a lot of smaller operations. I mean, it's just like a classic, like the electronics stuff. You have a proliferation of smaller operations all over the place, and then as some consolidate and become more efficient, the number will collapse in somewhat of the overall production and economic spinoff may still grow, but typically we have this proliferation and then you'll have a consolidation just because some people are more efficient than others, and also the system will devolve to its maximum efficiency and you'll have fewer that will be larger. And that's a normal market mechanism that results in the highest productivity for the least cost. And that happens with lots of different things. I mean, you can think of lots of them, and there will be a lot of companies that start up, there'll be a lot of companies that then go broke, and they're supposed to.
But the question becomes, how much tax credit money does the state want to throw into that gamble? Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it is, but you also have to figure out, I mean, if there's a financial spin-off against the tax credit you give that makes it worthwhile doing,
yeah.
It really doesn't matter. I mean, it really doesn't matter if it's explosive or small growth as long as there's an offset for the tax credit.
Chair Shazza, so we've talked a lot about the tax credit piece and the pollution control tax credit in specifics, but in my view going forward, that's certainly an issue. How's that going to be dealt with? It's going to be part of a biofuels package separate or whatever. But the fuel standard slash mandate issue is another key issue that has to be addressed. There was no resolution around that last session. The legislation referring to in Washington includes a fuel mandate. They're the second state in the country to require a certain amount of biodiesel and ethanol production after Minnesota. So there, at this point, there isn't a slew of states that have jumped onto that part of the bandwagon, and that's going to have to be assessed. In the case of Washington State, the Farm Bureau there was strongly supportive of the legislation. So the agricultural community saw it as a real economic opportunity and driver. Whether they're right or wrong, I couldn't give you. We need to talk to the experts on the industry and the scientists. But that's a key issue that's going to have to be grappled with. Where does the legislature feel about standards? Obviously, the petroleum industry is not supportive of the standards. They think that the incentive tax credits and incentives is the way to go on it. Others think that you need a mix of requirements along with incentives to maximize market opportunities.
David?
Just to comment on this, and I've been to at least two seminars. I was talking with the actual developers, and there are people in Oregon without any incentives now at all are coming into Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
We have one coming into Boardman right now. He is telling us that it's cheaper for him to buy $2 corn in Nebraska
in bulk, put it on a unit train, and this is where he makes his money, puts it on a unit train because he gets a lesser freight rate, ship it off to Oregon, put it right by the river, process it there, and then take the wherever the shipping costs go from that point. It's cheaper when it gets to the river. So he's going to go to the Midwest to buy his crops because that's the cheapest feedstock. You can say the same thing about canola because they're going to go to Canada. It's 7 cents a pound in Canada. But as a grower, I'm going to need 15 cents. So my choice is I'm probably not going to grow it. And I don't think, and then if you get into the amount of acres that Oregon has as far as crops, I think there's 4 million acres of cropland in Oregon. 1 million is wheat, 1 million is hay, and I don't know, the other 2 million are
everything else.
But there just aren't enough acres in Oregon to create a big enough industry. The industry can come here, but it's going to take crops from out. I'm encouraging the industry to come here, but let's be realistic about it. It's not going to be the Oregon farmer that's going to benefit it. It's going to be the Midwest farmer or somebody else.
Senator Nelson, I think that that's an accurate description of the current playing field. So that most of the existing, if you went into larger, we've got biodiesel producers in Oregon that are producing with local feedstock, whether it's vegetable waste, like sequential biofuels. So there is a local market, but for the large scale ethanol and potentially biodiesel folks, their feedstock is going to come in from out of state unless there's mechanisms that make it either required or through incentives, competitive in-state. But that's looking at the current playing field. And I think what we need to be thinking about with this industry is this industry is going to evolve rapidly over the next 5 years, 10 years, certainly 20 years. And so the question is where is it going to go? And we don't have certainty about where it's going to go. But we know that some of the things that are being looked at include the issue of cellulosic conversion, which opens up, if successful and if it comes to market, opens up a whole new raw material market for ethanol and potentially biodiesel, and makes Oregon potentially ideally situated for being competitive in terms. If you can use woody debris, and if you can use, like you're saying, the refuse from the ag crops, it's a whole different ball game. And so we need to be looking at making sure that we're creating a playing field in Oregon that's going to maximize the opportunity that if these things move forward, and I don't see them going backwards anywhere, that we're going to capitalize on it and be the first to capitalize on it.
Mr. Chair, I agree 100% with that. I know from a farmer's viewpoint, if I knew I could go out and bale my straw, and I could probably end up with maybe 6 tons of straw, or say 3 tons of straw off the wheat field. I know I could get $20 an acre or $20 a ton off that. That'd be $60 an acre. I mean, that for a dryland farmer, I think that pays most of my expenses. And so I think I can do this. Yeah. So that, I see there's a combination with this woody debris and the federal forest and all the things that are there. I think we have to look at it as a committee. How do you put all those things together? It's not so we have a lot of tools in the toolbox. That's what I'm after.
Chair, I'm going to go back to process here. I don't hear process. I hear late in session, we'll try to put something together. The governor's got some vague stuff going on. What I'm afraid of is the same thing this session with the last session. At the end, we'll get nothing because we just couldn't quite get there.
Senator Bates, our job. At least you were on the other committee, but when they put together the biofuels committee, our job was to try to come up with legislation in the interim that can be ready to go and dropped pre-session fund. At least when we were in Phoenix, Patty Smith and I talked about trying to get to legislation that we could agree on because there was no sense in the House doing one set of legislation and us doing another set. And she's even talking about us maybe getting together at some point and having a joint meeting of our two committees. So, you know, you don't see a process. If it's not being created anywhere else, then we need to create the process.
What point?
Because I think it would be a shame if we look at this, and we know what the component parts are, and we know what the problems are, and the difficulties, and we can't sort it out now. because that's what we need to do. I mean, we can sit here in neutral, and you'll see 34 other states go whizzing past. I mean, somehow they got past it in Washington State. Somehow they're getting it done in other states, and we don't want to stay stuck in the mud.
And if I could attend, I agree. I can't say what's going to happen with the pollution control tax credit and strategy and everything else and how that is going to play in, but I can say that there is a process around the biofuels piece. The governor has a work group that has been charged with developing proposed legislation for him to introduce next session. We're at the same time trying to coordinate very closely with your committee and with the House committee, and ideally we will come forward with a bipartisan bill that everybody agrees to pre-session, at the beginning of session. Now, other machinations or things that could occur, I can't predict, but I think we'll be in a position to have a biofuels package go forward at the beginning of session. Whether there's going to be pieces that are going to be pushed separate from any kind of a package, or if to what extent we can get agreement on a full package with both committees and both houses, that's what we need to try and work through in the interim, like you're saying. But I think we do have a process to get there on the biofuels piece. And I'm pretty optimistic that we should be able to get passage of biofuels legislation.
One more question,
Mr. Chairman.
What is the effect of the federal incentives in all this play?
On the biofuels?
Yeah. I mean, it's encouraging everything that we're supposed to be going on, but every state has that same incentive. So how does that play into this whole formula?
Senator Nelson, I can just give you my gut reaction. I haven't studied the federal incentives, but I know that there's requirements for a certain amount of biodiesel and ethanol production nationally, so that's not incentives. It's just a flat out, you know, the petroleum folks have to make it happen, or it has to happen. Where those gallons are going to be refined and made available, I don't know how the market's going to dictate that. There also are some incentives, and I'm not familiar with all of them, I'm sure, but there's for instance an incentive around utilizing 100 B100 or 100% mm-hmm. biodiesel. I think it's, if I'm not mistaken, $1 per gallon credit for the refiner, if I'm not mistaken. I think probably Brian has an answer to that, but to the blender. So that's a significant incentive, and we're waiting to see to some extent how much that trickles down to the market, so that if someone wants to put B100 in their vehicle, for instance, is that becoming more competitive than B20 or even more competitive than straight diesel prices? And I don't know if there's... Do you know where that B100 is as a market price compared to...
Well, it's a dollar per gallon of pure or biodiesel. Blend a
B10, you get 10 cents a gallon. Then, so it's like ethanol.
Ethanol is 52 cents a gallon.
Each of those are a per
meat.
E100,
if
you
blend
a
B10,
you get 10 cents a gallon.
Blend
credit.
Information overloader? Yeah.
Information overload. Yeah. I've said it too many times today. This has all been fascinating. We've arrived at the hour that I said we would quit. John, I want to thank you for being candid with us today. And, of course, you're always candid with us. At least you have been with me for the last several years. When I learned that this guy worked for the last Democrat governor of Idaho, I knew he had to be a good guy. So,
is he that old?
Is he that old? It hasn't been that long ago, I hate to tell you. But anyway, appreciate you coming and sharing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have all the component parts here, and I think it's going to become incumbent on us to talk with our colleagues in the House, talk with one another, bug the governor's office, and just keep working on it as much as we can. And I may insert another date into our agenda to push harder, or maybe that extra date that we have will be a joint committee with the House. It may be that we're not together again until we get together in Pendleton. Mm-hmm. I mean, after all this stuff, what are we going to Pendleton for? Oh, well, no, we've got April 7th. Mm-hmm. After that...
Well, they're talking about putting in an ethanol plant in Pendleton and a biodiesel plant. Well, I guess it's a combination of both. I think they can do ethanol first.
And that's why you're trying to get us to go to Pendleton.
But then also the Columbia River water. I want you to go out and look across there and see how much water is actually
out there. And this year.
And
may not look out at all.
And if any senators can walk on water, they win the governor's race. Yeah.
You better watch you convert to canola, right?
Yeah. Convert. And the other thing I have to do now is adjourn the committee, right?
Okay, very good. Next meeting, April 7th.
The next meeting is April 7th. We decided that, so we're adjourned.